Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Shortage of white people lately. I ain't seen no white folks no more. Y'all stop fucking?
Italy's birth rate is among the lowest in Europe, so the government launched a social media campaign encouraging people to have more children. Well, after just one day, it has gone viral, though not in the way that Italy had hoped. Christopher Lipsey reports from Rome.
Valentina Ognissanti works full-time for a travel company in Rome. She's 36, single, and doesn't have any kids yet.
Yeah, I do want kids, but maybe trying to build a career that will help me to have a family.
So she got a rude awakening when she opened Facebook and saw a meme that the health ministry is passing around. There's a picture of a woman holding up an hourglass and touching her belly. A caption in Italian reads,
La bellezza non ha età, la fertilità sì. Beauty doesn't have an age, fertility has. This is pretty offensive, especially because of her smug expression she's got on her face.
It's part of a government campaign to encourage parenthood in Italy. The health minister, Beatrice Lorenzin, is launching the country's first ever, quote, fertility day later this month. There are 12 promotional images, and they don't just target women. One shows a shriveled banana peel. The text reads, Male fertility is much more vulnerable than you think. Countless imitation memes have followed. One features an old man saying, When I was your age, I had 3 kids, and I lost one testicle in the war. Hashtag fertility day. Patrizio Nisirio is an author and journalist at the Italian news agency ANSA. He says the campaign isn't just a misstep, it also brings back haunting memories of fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, who made child-rearing a question of national duty.
And this campaign said fertility is a common good. Again, it kind of echoes that idea that, you know, it's not your own business whether you have children or not, but it's like the nation's need, which is kind of stupid, frankly.
But the government does have reason to worry. Last year, fewer babies were born in Italy than any time in history. Meanwhile, its population is both shrinking and living longer. That puts a heavy burden on the country's pension system. But critics argue the government should instead concentrate on improving the conditions for couples to have children, like offering the kind of generous maternity benefits seen in France and Germany. Even Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi seems to agree. He told Italian radio station RTL that young people have a hard time family planning when they often can't find steady work. He added, quote, None of my friends ever decided to have children after seeing an advertisement. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Livesay in Rome.
Decades ago, civil rights activists Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey urged African Americans to do business with each other to build wealth in their communities. The recent killings of black men by police officers and the Black Lives Matter movement have rekindled campaigns to buy and bank black. Some supporters are finding the call difficult to heed, as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
2 years ago, Camille H. decided to buy all her holiday gifts exclusively from Black-owned shops. That proved easy, but it also seemed insufficient.
I needed to do something a little bit more. I needed to do something more long-term.
She decided to carry her financial activism forward. She bought produce from Black farmers markets, but found it hard to find daily essentials at Black-owned stores.
Stuff like bread and cheese and boxed goods and, you know, all of the things that you would normally see in the aisles in the grocery store and not just the produce stuff. It was very difficult for me to find those items.
She drove 20 miles to the nearest Black-owned gas station. She opened an account at a Black-owned bank and found a Black accountant. But searching for products manufactured by Black companies was hard.
I did find a few things. I found a laundry detergent. I found toilet tissue. But then even when it came to buying these products, some stuff was only available online or really, really far away.
H, who uses the letter as her surname, lives in Los Angeles. She wanted to rent Black and find Black-owned utilities. It didn't work.
Black people just did not control enough resources at fundamental levels and in fundamental industries for me to make those types of decisions that I wanted to make.
Asian and Hispanic communities have more banking capital and create goods and services that allow them to recycle their money in their communities. Camille H. argues there needs to be an Own Black campaign.
That was one of the issues that I have with Buy Black, is that it really, really stressed the buying part and the consumerism part and not the owning and producing part.
And there are a growing number of voices rallying for the same. Rapper Killer Mike is credited with jumpstarting the Bank Black movement in July. Here he is in an interview with Atlanta's Hot 107.9.
Let $100 million move into that. Take that $100 million and promise $15,000 to $18,000 loans for Black businesses or small homes.
It's had a huge impact.
Terry Williams is president of Black-owned One United Bank.
We used to open about 50 accounts a day across, you know, all of our branches and online. We are now opening up to 1,000 accounts a day.
With the new demand, One United is opening a new call center in Miami, hiring 6 people, and looking into offering small business loans. Calls for Buy Black and Bank Black come at a time when the amount of money African Americans are spending as a group is growing faster than non-Hispanic whites. Their average age is younger, and they're more digitally engaged than other racial groups. That makes them increasingly important to all businesses, says Courtney Jones, vice president of multicultural growth and strategy for market research from Nielsen. But at the same time, Black-owned businesses don't want to be pigeonholed as just targeting their own. They ask her,
how can I craft a complete marketing strategy so that I am tapping into all the opportunity that exists for me?
That's a question Alicia Sargent grapples with. Sargent, along with 2 other Black women, co-founded dating site Go Dutch Today. She says she fights the notion that her business is just for Blacks. The website's main art features a white couple. Sargent says soon she hopes to feature many races.
As we look at our business, it's important for us to be as diverse as possible so that we are not labeled as the Black dating app, because that's not our goal.
Sargent says she's been accused of hiding who she is. Not true, she says. She just wants the site to have the broadest possible appeal. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Real estate always appreciates. It goes up in value. And I don't care about the naysayers saying, oh, what about the market that crashed? Yeah, you know what? You might get a up and down in real estate. Even when we may have a bad market every here and there, it still always rises. It always recovers because we always need somewhere to live. We always need somewhere to live.
It sounds like something that should be an easy fix.
But it's anything but. We first told you about some local homeowners who found racist language in old documents covering their new neighborhood last week. Those papers are decades old.
Now tonight, those homeowners were hoping to get that language erased, but it's not that simple. Fox 40's Ben DC joining us live tonight from El Dorado Hills. Good evening, Ben.
Good evening, Ty, Simone. You've got it right. These are racist relics from an America now 50, 60 years in the past, but they have a way of just sort of hanging around, and they're causing quite a bit of embarrassment to at least 3 different communities here in El Dorado Hills. Whites only, right there in black and white, on home ownership papers still in effect, some places in El Dorado Hills.
Me, I'm embarrassed as an El Dorado Hills resident.
The revelation of the racist rules isn't welcome in homes here.
Among other things, inappropriate, illegal, reprehensible.
And the El Dorado Hills Community Services District says the racist rules aren't enforced here either. But getting rid of them isn't as easy as getting out an eraser.
Challenging, definitely challenging. Anytime you want to get some sort of change in any community in this day and age where people may not be voting in a high turnout.
You heard him right. To legally amend this illegal agreement, you still need a majority vote of the homeowners affected.
Come on! Exactly. Come on here! Nice.
Lisa Letta Foster and her husband Cameron first called attention to the Caucasian clause in a Fox 40 report, called attention to it, and called for it to be stricken from their homeownership documents. They just learned tonight they'll have to get at least half of their 300 homeowning neighbors to sign off before the rules are changed.
I actually have a lot of friends and family that have said, oh yeah, I'll petition with you, and they're not even living in El Dorado Hills.
Sometimes people going door to door knocking works out great. Luckily for us, the media has helped out in this case in calling attention to this matter.
It sounds unlikely, impossible perhaps, but the fact is clauses like this are in documents, home ownership documents all around the country, all around Northern California. In fact, there are a number of them in a number of communities in Sacramento. So if you are a homeowner, you may want to break out that banker's box full of documents and take a second look. You could very well have one of these types of clauses in your own paperwork. Reporting live from El Dorado Hills, Ben Deasy, Fox 40 News.
All right, hope they can get that updated sooner rather than later, Ben. Thank you.
But they have a way of just sort of hanging around. Hanging.
2 years ago today, 17-year-old Lennon Lacey was found hanging from a swing set in a Bladenboro, North Carolina trailer park. Local and federal officials ruled the death of this African-American teenager a suicide. Race and Southern Culture reporter Leonie Dinge visited the Lacey family. They still believe Lennon Lacey was lynched.
Claudia Lacey has a Sunday ritual. She begins Sunday mornings at First Baptist Church on Martin Luther King Jr. Street in Bladenboro, the church her family helped build.
And I lean on my church family 100%. I wouldn't know what to do without them. I wouldn't.
Bless your heart, man. You know I love you.
I know, Mama. Okay. Thank you.
This was not a normal Sunday. Claudia Lacey's son, Lennon Lacey, would have turned 19 years old on Sunday, August 14th, if he were alive. Family members like Wilson Lacey fondly remember the teenager.
He was a real quiet young fella. He didn't have a whole lot to say and real mannerly.
But they also remember the days leading up to Lennon Lacey's death. Lennon Lacey, who is black, was in a messy public relationship with a white woman who was more than 10 years older. Bladenboro is small, only about 1,700 people. It's 72% white, and the median household income is only $20,000, less than half of what it is for the state. Word of Lennon Lacey's death traveled fast. Here is the 911 call.
Boynton Communications, Patty.
Patty.
Yeah.
Sheriff Benson, I need EMS. I have a man hanging from a swing set. Bladen Rental Properties, Highway 211.
Wilson Lacey says Lennon Lacey is likely dead because of race, and he doesn't know when they'll get justice.
We have the situation with Emmett Till and situations like that, that sometimes it takes years for God to show the justice he wants to show.
In 1955, Emmett Till, an African-American teenager, was brutally beaten and lynched in Mississippi for reportedly flirting with a white woman. There have been thousands of lynching deaths, mostly in the South, since the end of slavery to the 1950s. But the NAACP says just as disturbing are the more recent hanging deaths of black men, quickly ruled as suicides. North Carolina NAACP President, the Reverend William Barber, led a demonstration in Blatantboro a few months after Lennon Lacey's death.
We don't want the FBI to be calm. No. We don't want you to be detached. Right. We want you to hear his name in your sleep while you're driving. Lennon Lacey. Somebody say it. Lennon Lacey.
This scene is part of the documentary film Always in Season, produced by filmmaker Jacqueline Olive. She examines the lingering impact of more than a century of lynching in the U.S. The film airs on PBS next year.
Everybody's out here, all the family, grandparents over there, all the other ancestors over there.
This is her mom and dad over here.
This is my mom and daddy here.
After church, Claudia Lacey always stops by the family cemetery, the resting place of her son and several other relatives. It's not far from her home, which is also close to where Lennon Lacey was found hanging from a swing set.
I come here because, like, I see the solitude, just the emptiness of him not being physically here with me. I just need that connection.
Claudia Lacey says she still doesn't have enough proof her son wasn't lynched.
I need the proof. I need it on paper. I need it scientifically noted. I want to know this is the real reason this happened.
The Lacey family may never have the justice they want and need. Earlier this summer, the U.S. Justice Department closed their investigation into the death of Lennon Lacey, saying there was no evidence that his death was a homicide or a hate crime. Leonida Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
I'm willing to die for my colors.
Hear now this lyric from a man whose name adorns one of the most famous buildings in Washington, D.C., the Russell Senate Office Building, where mostly white men spoke to history in grand lyrics of the principles they held dear. Richard Russell said this: as one who was born and reared in the atmosphere of the Old South with six generations of my forebears now resting beneath Southern soil, I am willing to go as far and make as great a sacrifice to preserve and ensure white supremacy in the social, economic, and political life of our state as any man who lives within her borders. That's Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who was willing to lay down his life for white supremacy.
And I'm willing to die for my colors.
Feels and sounds upsetting, so far out of the mainstream of today's politics. Coming from a man who quite legally and proudly, and under banner headlines in the leading newspapers of the day, filibustered a civil rights bill back in 1935, an anti-lynching bill. He spoke for six straight days to preserve the legality of hanging black people in public by their necks until they were dead, an act we would call terrorism today, called patriotism then. I want to warn you that the language of this legal American politics we like to think of in the abstract is only going to get more upsetting in this little segment, and perhaps you may want to stop listening now, but I hope you don't. At precisely 8:54 p.m. on August 28, 1957, the longest continuous filibuster in U.S. history began as a final stand against a tide of history that was overwhelming the forces of racism and white supremacy that dominated the South and the Southern lawmakers in the U.S. Congress.
The Southern revolt against President Truman reaches its climax at Birmingham under the state's rights banner. Venerable Alfalfa Bill Murray comes out of retirement to join in the protest against the president's civil rights program. More than 6,000 flock to the Rump Convention to select the presidential ticket. In the forefront of the move are Alabama and Mississippi delegates. 13 Southern states are represented in the uproarious session, which precedes the nomination of Governors Thurmond of South Carolina and Fielding Wright of Mississippi as party standard bearers.
A decade before Strom Thurmond's filibuster in 1957, Southern state separatist leaders had revolted in opposition to President Truman's civil rights platform. Democrats dubbed themselves Dixiecrats and spoke about taking back their country, that was being turned into an unrecognizable dictatorship. Here's Democrat Strom Thurmond speaking back then like a member of the Republican faction we would call the Tea Party today.
It simply means that it's another effort on the part of the president to dominate the country by force and to put into effect these uncalled for and these damnable proposals he has recommended under the guise of so-called civil rights. And I tell you, the American people from one side or the other had better wake up and oppose such a program. And if they don't, the next thing will be a totalitarian state in these United States.
But this language you're about to hear, you won't hear from the Tea Party today, even though it was legal, permissible, newsworthy, and part of the so-called racial debate back in the 1950s and 60s.
There's not enough troops in the army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches.
Listen to that. Admit the nigger race into our theaters, swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches. End quote. My God, that is upsetting to say. And I grew up at a time when people around me said it all the time. This was a U.S. Senator, Strom Thurmond, who holds a record for filibustering that we may be tempted to note as some kind of Olympic event, continuously talking from 8:54 p.m. on August 28, 1957, to 9:12 p.m. August 29, 1957, the longest filibuster in history, 24 hours, 18 minutes, but it's no Olympic event. It's a lyric of hatred and endorsement of violence and bigotry that stands as a national shame. There's no recording of it. They didn't record it in the Senate back then. But here's some of what he said. Quote, "I am convinced that this is bad proposed legislation which never should have been introduced and which never should have been approved by the Senate. I urge every member of this body to consider this bill most carefully. I hope the Senate will see fit to kill it." That word kill feels as reckless and brutal and offensive as that N-word, spoken without a care in the world in this lyric of hate. A lament for a tradition of segregation, vigilantism, death, and hatred. Disguised as something called states' rights, a principle spoken of quite vigorously today in debates. Governor Strom Thurmond was the party presidential nominee of the Dixiecrats back in 1948. There's a monument to him in Washington and Alabama, places where you can see no monuments or commemoration of the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, or segregation. Well, maybe there's the White House. It was built by slaves, after all, the First Lady reminded us recently. We should also note that Strom Thurmond lost the political battle. He holds the record for filibustering on that day in 1957.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
Over the last 4 years, the Obama administration has championed an ambitious campaign to defend the rights of LGBT people overseas, especially in Africa. Homosexuality is illegal across much of the African continent. NPR's Gregory Warner brings us two LGBT activists who are wrestling with the double-edged sword of American support. When more visibility can mean more vulnerability, an outsider's protection can complicate the path to acceptance.
Everyone knew, when President Obama made his visit to Kenya last summer, that he would say something about gay rights. American activists were pressing him to condemn Kenya's colonial-era law making homosexuality a crime. Kenyan politicians were grandstanding against unwelcome lectures from the West. And in all this debate over the politics, many members of the Kenyan LGBT community wanted one thing above all: safety.
That was the most tense in our life. Like, we were so worried before Obama came.
John Mathenge is director of a local community center and clinic in Nairobi. It's called Hoimas. He says in the weeks before Obama's visit, homophobic attacks increased all across Kenya. People were so scared that they stopped coming to his clinic, even to pick up HIV meds. Finally, the day of the visit arrived.
I've been consistent all across Africa on this.
President Obama spoke at a press conference at the Kenyan State House.
I believe in the principle of treating people equally under the law.
And when the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, rose to respond, he at first seemed to hide behind the culture argument.
It's very difficult for us to be able to impose on people that which they themselves do not accept.
But then he uttered a phrase that somehow seemed to appease both Kenyans opposed to gay rights and many members of the Kenyan LGBT community.
For Kenyans today, the issue of gay rights is really a non-issue.
Gay rights, he said, is a non-issue in Kenya. Now, this moment of a much longer press conference was seized on by American commentators as a rebuttal to Obama, or even a rationalization for violence. But John Mathenge, the gay activist, says that phrase saved lives. The anti-gay rhetoric from Kenyan politicians immediately cooled down. An anti-homosexuality bill in parliament was quietly killed.
When the president spoke like it's an issue, he told people concentrate on things to build the country, not to think about people's bed.
John Mathenge, I should say, is not the conflict-avoiding type. He is an openly gay man in Kenya, that's a rarity, and he's a named plaintiff on a lawsuit in Kenyan courts trying to strike down that law that makes homosexuality illegal. So he is someone who has sought the spotlight despite the dangers. What dismays him about the American campaign for LGBT rights in Africa is not that it makes the community or their issues more visible. It's that it bolsters, unintentionally, a piece of propaganda that's often used to discredit African activists.
This is not a Kenyan thing. This is a Western thing. Why is he being pushed by the white men?
This idea that homosexuality is a kind of Western import, it's particularly demoralizing to Mathenge when he recalls his long, hard journey to come out, first to himself and then to his family.
I've always been who I am, and I'll remain who I am. I know they say sometimes we are agent of the white people or we are agent of the Obama. No, that's a lie.
But that lie does make it harder to gain the trust, let alone the acceptance, of his fellow Kenyans. And so Mathenge says he does want President Obama and U.S. diplomats to keep speaking out.
But at the same time, they should only speak when we speak.
When I left Mathenge's office, though, I wondered how people would answer this question in a country where gays and lesbians can't risk such a public stance, where coming out can be even more perilous. So I left Nairobi and I flew over the border to Kampala, Uganda. And I met this guy.
My name is Pepe Julian Onzima.
Onzima is a transgender man and a Ugandan activist. And just 2 days before my arrival, he'd been arrested at a secret gay pride event at a private bar. This was his fifth arrest in Uganda over the last 8 years. But this time was different. Not only were the police more violent, they beat him with batons on the way to the station, but they also taunted him for his American support.
They're like, okay, let's see how your American money is going to get you out of this today. It's definitely connected to the perceptions that they have about us, that we have money, that the West has given us money, and that, you know, the West is protecting us.
Anziema says he can almost understand his tormentors because he is a well-known Ugandan LGBT activist in a country where America is paying attention to this issue. Anziema enjoys a political clout that's far out of reach of the average Ugandan. He can call a U.S. diplomat on his cell phone or a high-level government official, and these Ugandan cops seem to resent him for it. Once off the police truck and booked at the station, Onzema was tossed into a prison cell where inmates were instructed to take care of him.
So it was in there that, you know, the beating started. They just, like, kept on hitting me and hitting me and hitting me. And thank God for the intervention that, you know, the 1 hour ended. When it did.
It only ended because of the hurried tweets that Onzema and others had made earlier to alert the U.S. Embassy, and the Americans intervened.
The irony is that, in a way, it was the American money, or not the American money, but your American connections that did get you out of that prison.
Yes. Our so-called U.S. money saved us anyway. Oh, man.
Now, every American attempt to intervene around the world is always going to risk unintended consequences, but Onzema faces a particularly cruel paradox. The more public protection he gets from America, from the American-backed Ugandan government, the more he's an object of envy and outrage from ordinary Ugandans, and thus, the more protection he needs.
The irony of American money. It's just the power it gives you and then how powerless it leaves you at the same time.
How should Americans feel about that?
Exactly. I think the fact that I'm seated here talking, they should feel proud.
Proud that he's not still in a prison cell. Proud that he's even able to discuss these fairly nuanced contradictions of diplomacy. Proud that he has a voice, even if it came at a price. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Kampala.
You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Eusebius. Excellent, excellent show. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I've tried for 2 days to get through to you, to the station. I just had this burning desire to share with you my little story.
Please do.
Thank you. And yes, I was one of those parents that that really needed to get my kids into a good school. And fortunately enough for me, I was able to send my kids to private schools. Mm. And this is the story that I would love to share with you. I have a 24-year-old daughter who's gone to a small convent private school for girls. And I called her when the story broke, and I said to her, did you hear about Pretoria girls? Did you hear? Apparently, girls are not allowed to speak their languages in the corridors. Girls are forced to relax their hair. But boy, oh boy, Eusebius, when I mentioned that, I opened up a whole can of worms. Mm. This girl was ready to engage with me. She said to me, but Mom, this is what happened at my school. I said, what? She says, yes, girls were not allowed to speak their languages on the school premises. And I said to her, really, during my time? And, you know, I can't believe this happened on my clock. Mm. She says, yes, Mom, the thing is, she said, the thing is because white people made us to believe, and they brainwashed us to believe that the perfect English is the only thing that was acceptable. The straight hair was the only thing that was acceptable. And we actually didn't even, we had blinkers on. We didn't even realize that it was wrong. And so this is what my daughter was saying. She says, Mom, you were one of those people that were brainwashed. And so were we when we were at school. Mm. She said, until I went to university and I walked in there with my chip on my shoulder, thinking that because I speak a better English with a better accent, I was better than everybody else over there. Mm. She said, and that's when I started asking myself these very difficult questions. But am I? And you know, and she started debating these things with herself. Eusebius, I was knocked over. Mm. I didn't even realize that my daughter gave this discussion such deep thought. I thought when I called her, she was going to say, yeah, Mom, these are just a bunch of girls that want to make their fashion statement, and then I should sit down, and this is discipline. I thought that would be her reaction to it. This girl knocked me over. And you know, Eusebius, I sat down and I thought, wow. This cannot be happening in our schools. This is more than just hair. She actually mentioned to me, she said to me, Mom, remember when I was a prefect? She says, one of my very good friends, and I know this girl, she said to me, Mom, this girl came to me and said, you know, Lindsay, I am so, so upset. I am so deeply hurt. And she said to this girl, why? When I talked to me, and this girl said, because teachers just had a good laugh. Somebody said, oh, black people can't say seven. They say seven, and everybody started laughing and made fun of it. And I was so deeply, deeply hurt. Mm. And I think, Eusebius, these are the kind of things that white people don't realize that we have to deal with every day, whether it happens in the workplace, whether it happens in the schools, whether it happens on the sports grounds. Mm. And I think, Eusebius, also, there is this perception that if there's a nice a number of black representation, there cannot be racism. Mm, but we forget that who runs these institutions. Mm. We are forgetting who are at the heart and the coalface of these institutions. And the policies still exist that were there 20 years ago. And people say, get on with it. Get on with it. This baby's now 20 years old. This baby can now think for himself. This baby should now not sit in a corner and cry racism. But we haven't had these discussions with this baby. We haven't.
Natasha, can I ask you this question? I mean, your call is beautiful, it's painful, it's profound, it's reflective, and so much more in other adjectives. How do you feel as a parent when you invested in your child's education in a private school, no doubt expensive, elite, and you hope that you've done the right thing to do so, and then you find out when your child is an adult that actually there were forms of institutional violence that you were unaware as a parent they might have experienced silently. That call, when you made that call to your daughter, what reflections came up for you afterwards about you as a parent while you were parenting a young lady in high school?
You see, Beth, I was totally, totally shocked. I was flabbergasted. I was knocked right over onto my back. I think I have robbed my daughter from an opportunity to live in the real world. And as she said to me, I had this perception of life until I went to varsity and I was back in the pool with everybody else and I had to deal with everybody else around me. And this is when she really started to investigate herself. And I felt hurt, you see, this, and I felt hurt that she actually never came to me and had this discussion with me. At the same time, I almost felt betrayed by the school that I... And I think, you see, this, let me say this. I don't think it was a deliberate thing from the school side. You know, Julie Maruncela was talking about that.
But what I mean in part, Natasha, is that is there a part of you, and I don't think you should feel like this, but I'm curious whether you might. You're obviously a conscious mom. A conscious mom is a mom who is still friends with their daughter and calls them up and have a lekker chat about the world, as you have done with your daughter. But do you feel like you ought to have been more aware? Because part of this conversation has now been about the degree of participation of black parents on school governing bodies, being more vigilant. The fact that teenage daughters are going viral is cool, but where are we as adults in this conversation? Do you feel that you ought to have been more aware of dynamics at this private school as a mom?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And this is why I have this burning desire to make the school, because I want to say to moms out there, and I'm sure there are so many like myself that were sending our kids to school. You know, we were living by the code of conduct and we were just ignorant around these facts. Mm-hmm. And I think we should have these discussions. And I think schools should have these discussions where they, you know, let's air these policies.
Absolutely, Natasha. Thank you so much for your bravery, for your reflections. And I think for the kind of communication channels you've opened up about your daughter and suddenly realizing that their experiences were not quite what you thought they were when you invested in expensive education.
That's a nappy-headed horse there, I'm going to tell you that now.
We've got, is it Milchka on the line? Milchka or Mishka? Good morning.
Hi, John.
Good morning. Is it Milchka or Mishka?
It's Mishka.
Mishka, how are you doing? Mishka, go for
I'm
it.
I'm good. Hi, John.
Go. Yes, I'm very well, and you, Mishka?
I'm great, thanks.
Go for it.
Okay, so I was just at Pretoria High School for Girls about 10 minutes ago.
Yes.
The entire school is basically on lockdown. There's a heavy security presence. I spoke to a few teachers. They said that administration had a meeting this morning that said that everything should go along as normal. And if there is any protest action, they will be calling the police to action, which I find to be incredibly disturbing considering that there are young girls on the property and the protest action was going to be started by old girls or former students.
Now you're, hold on, Miss. You're a journalist, is that right? Who are you, Mishka?
My full name is Mishka Waza. I'm a journalist for the Daily Vox.
Yes.
And I'm a politics editor for Activate Online, Rhode University student newspaper.
Ah, okay. All right. So you went and had a look at this, and the situation is tense.
It is very tense.
And the issue itself, I mean, have you looked into it? Have you spoken it? Presumably, you would agree that a school has the right to set some form of rules regarding dress, regarding hair. But obviously, in this case, it's a difficult one, and many other cases.
Yes, definitely. I did attend Gold High for 5 years, and I do think that the rules that they tend to enforce are extremely stringent and borderline racist.
Okay, so what rules would you have?
Well, as an Indian girl, I did not experience, or my lived experience is very different to the lived experience of the black girls after school. But obviously, I did have black friends, and they were not allowed to have their hair in very long braids. They were not allowed dreadlocks. They were not allowed afros. I think that the rule overturning the ban on afros only happened in my matric year, which was last year. And even then, the afros have to be very small, which is difficult to maintain. I mean, afros themselves are very difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
There are incredibly stringent rules regarding uniforms. And in a school where many of the students are not from economically advantaged backgrounds, the rules that they had in terms of the length of dresses, the way that the dresses looked, we even had rules regarding socks, like the way that your socks had to be tied.
Yes.
They were all just extremely unnecessary. And the teachers would go on and the administration would go on about it being part of tradition. But my question is, whose tradition?
I agree with you totally, Mishka. What I can't understand is, and maybe it's unfair to focus on one particular school, but having said that, that's the one you visited. A school like that, which also has got a very, very good reputation, how have they not spoken to the kids already? How have they not spoken to parents? How have they not looked at an issue which I would not believe they believe is racist? I'm not saying it's not racist, Mishka. I'm saying I doubt if anybody from Pretoria Girls High would say we are a racist school. Why has this not been raised and dealt with in a way that is much more, I suppose, constructive than destructive? And that's what amazes me.
Well, to be honest with you, John, because I was in the school for 5 years, I do know how it works. I was very involved with the school as well. What the administration does do is silence people. If you have a complaint, all you do is put a piece of paper under the principal's, the headmistress's door, and no one looks at it. No one adjusts any rules. No one comes back to you about the rules. All they do is a sort of bureaucratic process where you're expected to give the complaint and nothing happens. And if the complaint irks someone, then you get a disciplinary hearing or you get suspended. The rules there are just, they literally just make no sense, I think, for an adolescent girl.
But Mishka, all of us in school think the rules make no sense. All of us think we know more than the teachers do. You've got to have a boundary line somewhere, because there is an element of discipline. There is an element of youthful exuberance that maybe can cross lines. Surely you accept that.
But I think that the problem here is that we're not talking about youthful exuberance. We're talking about self-expression. We're talking about identity.
But self-expression can also have limits in a school, surely. You can't have people, half naked. You can't have people painting themselves because they want to exhibit self-expression. I mean, when you're youngsters and kids, you say, hang on a second, anything goes, because we're cool, we're youngsters, the world belongs to us. And when you're later, you say, well, hang on a second, maybe that discipline did, in fact, cause me to be a better person, etc. You've got to have some rules, haven't you?
I hear you, but the problem here is that the self-expression we're talking about is not painting or doing anything weird to your hair. The self-expression here is about basic cultural identity, the way that you wear your hair, the types of cultural and religious ornaments that you're allowed to wear.
Where would you draw the line on braids? Or would you? Can people, I mean, you've
I would not draw the line on braids, because I'm not a black girl. I'm not a black woman. I have no right to talk about black women's hair.
But I've seen braids that look fantastic, and I've seen braids which are so incredibly over the top that they are showbiz things with hair all over the place. I can't use the correct terms, etc. Would you say anything goes there, Mishka?
Josh, John, sorry. John, I think that the problem here is that you're a white man and you really don't have any right to comment on black women's braids, and neither do I. And I think that if black girls wish to express themselves, the thing is,
I thought I had a right when there's freedom of speech to comment on anything.
No, that's not how freedom of speech works.
Well, you tell me what I've got a right to comment on, Mishka.
You really don't have the right to comment on the very specific lived experiences of marginalized and depressed groups in the country.
Then I don't have the right to comment on virtually anything.
Black women's hair is an extremely contentious issue in the country. It has been a contentious issue since colonial times. And the way that black women are reclaiming their hair, or rather claiming their hair because they were never allowed to claim it in the first place, is an issue that they have to deal with by themselves.
All right.
We have no right, or rather non-black people have no rights to talk to them about how to wear their hair or what goes in which situations.
Not even to discuss it.
I think you can discuss it.
Oh, I can discuss it. I can discuss it. Okay. All
right. When in a discussion you begin speaking over black women, which is often the case, that becomes an issue.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Mishka Wazar, journalist and political editor for Activate Online, which is a student's news portal. All right. And don't get me wrong, because I don't believe that racism can be experienced by white people, I've told you. I think the racism is something experienced by black people. That's a lesson that I have learned. But now I'm told we cannot discuss issues to do with the, well, you heard what Mishka said. In this country, there's nothing worse than being branded a racist. Unless, I suppose, you're stuck in the old South Africa. You're some sort of right-winger who'll wear it as a badge of honour. But for most people, it's the worst thing that can be laid against you. Well, I'm in that place at the moment, and I can tell you it is not nice. It hurts a lot. Yesterday, we had this issue of complaints into hair policy and allegations of racism at a famous school in Pretoria. I said I was surprised at this based on the reputation, and the MEC agreed with me. And I do not and never did claim to be an expert on female hairstyles. So we put on a journalist and blogger who called in to explain it, and I did my job and I questioned her, and I was told I had no right to comment on the issue, and neither did she, as she's a South African of Indian descent. Well, I disagreed with this, and I still disagree, because I think there is freedom of speech in this country. In the old days, I spoke about racism against racism on 702 since I've been on 702, and I was threatened and abused by white people for doing it. And the point is that the thing that seems to have got most people upset and abusive is the term I used, showbiz. For some reason, I used that term, and I was referring to hairstyles I have seen with multicolors and, to me, unusual shapes and sizes. And I said I battled to describe it. I'm not an expert. And the scariest thing about Twitter is that from the comments, the vast majority of people did not hear the interview, have not heard the show, but have labeled me a racist and threatened all sorts of things. Well, I'm telling you it hurts, and I'm not going to pretend it doesn't. And if I am racist, then I'm very, very concerned. And I apologize for it, but I still do not understand the issue at stake here. In this case, based on what I said, and it concerns me very, very deeply, so please tell me so I can change my ways, and I'm being dead serious about that. Let's see what we can learn.
A Baytown teenager is fighting back tonight after she was told she may not be able to cheer at a football game because of her hairstyle. Well, her family believes it goes beyond school policy into a much bigger issue. Eyewitness News reporter Kevin Quinn joins us live with this story, all new at 6. Kevin?
Yeah, Dave, that teen's mother says the only explanation for this is discrimination based on race. She says it's been going on for about a year now, far too long.
So was that your
15-year-old Kimira Jean-Marie is a flyer on the Ross Sterling varsity cheer squad in Baytown.
The coach makes it hard to be on varsity.
She says the coach has been on her repeatedly about her hair, so much so that she claims it's damaged her self-esteem.
She makes me feel bad about myself, kind of.
This year, she says she had special braids done in the hope of meeting cheer requirements. Her mother says things really got out of hand last week when the coach told Kimira she wouldn't be able to perform at Saturday's football game if she showed up as she did at school with her hair and braids, even though it was in a ponytail.
I said, if that's the case, put it in writing. Just put it in writing.
She says the school district refused. What is in writing are these Sterling High cheer guidelines, only stating hair must be pulled back in a secure ponytail, that the hair must not distract from the cheer environment, and that an administrator will determine if a hairstyle is disruptive.
I feel like she singles me out.
Kimira says other girls are given more leeway in hairstyles. Nowhere in the guidelines does it say anything about prohibiting braids. As the only African-American on the cheer squad, she and her mother say the coach seems to be more adamant about complaints against her.
She's been harassed. She's been bullied by this particular teacher, and I'm tired of it.
Now, a spokesperson for Goose Creek Consolidated Independent School District says this was only a simple disagreement over hairstyles, telling us in part, quote, this student is not the only cheerleader who has been asked to correct her hairstyle or other parts of her uniform. Further, she was in no way reprimanded, punished, or kept from participating. She was simply reminded to use the agreed upon hairstyle. In no way do we discriminate or tolerate discrimination of any student. By the way, Kamira did go to that game with the braids in her hair, and she was still allowed to perform. We're live in Baytown. Kevin Quinn, 13 Eyewitness News.
The prestigious Georgetown University announced today a formal apology to the families of the slaves sold to keep the school afloat. If you're not familiar, the school made a fair amount of money on the backs of slaves owned by Jesuits who created the institution. And in 1838, 272 slaves were sold to pay off school debts. Once the story became public a little while back, the school's president put together a task force to study what they should do. And all that they came up with was saying sorry, a few other topical changes to the curriculum and campus buildings, and oh, legacy status and admission for descendants of said slaves. But no money. No financial aid preference or scholarship packages for the families of those sold. After all that, a 100-plus page report and 20 really smart people taking weeks to figure something out, still no cash. Slaves work for free. Georgetown University made money off slaves. Yet their solution? Keep the money. Think about that. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
So sorry.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
My child matters. Her child matters. All these children matter.
Emotions running high again at Buckeye Union High School in the Southwest Valley over a Black Lives Matter t-shirt flap that sparked threats of violence with racial undertones. Family and friends of the student at the center of the debate rallying to support her. And as William Pitts shows us, protesters today hope that hate and intolerance around campus will subside.
We're fired up. We can't take it no more.
That was the message Mariah Havard and nine other students had for their classmates and the administration at Buckeye High School when they walked out of class this morning.
Can't take it no more.
Last week, Mariah was sent home after wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, which the school says violated the student dress code policy. Mariah's mother says since then, her daughter and others have experienced physical and racial intimidation that has amounted to...
There's been threats. The kids have been threats. They've been, you know, racial slurs. The same young man that said this to my daughter called another young lady the N-word.
Cheyenne McNeil says she felt the mood around the school change over the past week.
I just get a lot of dirty looks a lot, and I don't like that.
At a small rally off the school grounds, parents said the tension on campus goes well beyond one student's wardrobe choice and needs to be addressed by the administration.
Because of the way the issue was handled afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's where the conflict is.
Last week, the assistant principal we spoke to cited the school's dress code policy, which bans clothing and accessories which can, quote, disrupt the education process.
They're not out here saying, you know, we don't want to go to school. They're saying we want to be treated fairly in school and we want to be protected in school.
William Pitts, 12 News.
The Buckeye Police Chief tells 12 News that he's had units on campus a few times last week, but has nothing to report.
So, Buckeye Union High School. There were students that walked out. Why did they walk out? They walked out in protest of a sophomore girl who's being disciplined for wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt.
Racist.
Oh, they're racist.
Yeah.
School's racist.
How dare you kick me out because I'm wearing a t-shirt?
They probably, and then 10 students followed and said they feel it's racist and we're going to leave school. Okay. I wonder how their parents feel about that. Probably not too good. You know what? You can't wear whatever you want to school. I mean, that's really it. You want to talk about having rights. Well, you really, as a kid, you don't have a whole lot of rights when it comes to going to a school. If you wear a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, if you wear a t-shirt that has maybe suggestive language on it or foul language or pro-Trump.
Political message.
Pro-Hillary.
Yeah.
you know, anything that's kind of controversial,
right.
And I put Black Lives Matter right under controversial.
Anything
controversial
that causes a distraction in the school.
You're going to be asked.
Black Lives Matter would seem to be.
Yeah, you're going to be asked to leave. It's not like you're walking in a Diamondbacks T-shirt. Okay,
it's not your school.
I mean, if you walk in a Cardinals shirt, that's not, you know, if you walk in a blank the Cardinals shirt, that's
right,
something
right,
different.
Right.
Okay. So I don't think this is a racial thing from everything that I, you know, read and we made some phone calls about this story.
But the students are taking it as though they're saying it is racism or some kind of bigotry because they're not allowed to wear the shirt. And then they go back to, you know, their First Amendment rights. Look, again. It says a lot that kids growing up these days don't understand what truly is bigotry and racism because it does exist. It still exists.
But
and
some kids get it. I mean,
but they're not the ones marching out on this because of a T-shirt.
Mm.
You know, that's the part that really, if I'm a high school teacher, I don't know what to say to these kids because they feel that they have every right to be indignant. They feel as though they have been wronged. When actually all it is their rules. Mm-hmm. You have to have rules. And one of the rules is no distracting T-shirts or apparel. So this is under the umbrella of distraction.
You know, when this girl was sent home, there were racist comments posted on Facebook about her actions. That's pretty horrific. And I hope the school looks and finds out who the kids are that are posting racist things. Because you need a big stop and chat. You need an auditorium.
Absolutely.
You need the people, you need the kids to sit down, and you've got to now have a talk. Because you know what? It's one thing to wear a Black Lives Matter T-shirt to school and get sent home for it. It's a totally another thing. If you see that kid in a Black Lives Matter T-shirt and you start calling her names.
Right.
That's
right.
Wrong.
Absolutely.
I'ma put you on game for the names that don't know they're rookie. Instagram is the best way to promote some.
It's become a real question now that people often use real-time connections like Facebook Live to record and stream standoffs with law enforcement. When and whether should police be able to pull the plug on your social media? NPR's Martin Costi has been looking into it.
People are talking about this right now because of the case of a woman named Corinne Gaines, who was shot and killed earlier this month by police in Baltimore County, Maryland. Before she was shot, there was a standoff with the cops outside her apartment trying to get her to surrender. And during those hours, she was online. This is one of the videos that she posted on Instagram, where she's talking about the standoff with her 5-year-old son.
What's happening right now? Who's outside?
The police.
What are they trying to do?
What's got people's attention here is the fact that during the standoff, the police got Instagram's parent company, Facebook, to suspend her account. They say they did this because her social media connection was making the standoff worse. It was distracting her from negotiations, and some of her online followers were telling her not to give up.
In some cases, the person is looking for an audience.
Police tactics expert Sid Hale says outside communications can complicate a standoff, a problem that was easier to fix in the old days.
Usually we would surround the house and then call the guy on his own phone, say, come on out. And that it prevented him from talking to anybody else as long as we just kept the line open. And if it got really bad, we just literally cut the wire at the house.
These days, the police can use a special web page provided by the social media company where they can make an emergency request to take down somebody's account. For cops, this is no different than the old practice of cutting a phone line. But to Rashad Robinson, it is different. He runs Color of Change, an online racial justice organization. And he says live social media are much more than just a line of communication.
As the movement around police accountability has grown, it's been fueled by video evidence, the type of video that gives us a real insight into what's happening and creates the narrative and builds the narrative for people to understand.
He says imagine if police in Minnesota had blocked the Facebook Live video of the aftermath of the police shooting of Philando Castile earlier this summer. There wouldn't have been nearly the same kind of public reaction. And in fact, that video did disappear for a while. Facebook blamed a technical glitch. Robinson says tech companies need to establish clear principles for when and how they let the police take people offline.
Facebook and these other platforms have to decide what they're going to be. Are they the phone company or are they a news agency? And they can sort of pick and choose depending on sort of the time of day.
His group and a long list of others have sent Facebook a letter demanding an explanation of the Corinne Gaines takedown and clear rules for the future. Facebook says it does have clear rules. It responds to emergency requests from the police when there's a risk of death or serious injury or imminent harm to a child. But the company won't discuss specific cases, and activists say it's leaving itself a lot of gray area where it can judge cases as it sees fit. Meanwhile, live social media, especially video, just keeps getting more important to civic life. Kate Klonick studies this at Yale Law School.
What's really interesting, I guess, about the live video feed is how quickly people are going to feel entitled to it and like it's part of their civic rights.
But of course, social media is not a legally defined right, at least not yet. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Don't resist a pit and pie. You think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
Turn around and face that way now, or I'll spray you.
To the police. You hey, yeah, hey, man. Hey, my mama's 84 years old, mother.
Body cam video from Muskogee police generating a lot of controversy tonight. Black community leaders in Muskogee are calling for changes in police training and policies. That's after an 84-year-old woman was hit with pepper spray earlier this month. Channel 8's Charles Ely reports that think progress is being made and they're glad their city has been peaceful. He's live tonight in Muskogee. Chuck.
That's right, Mark. They hope that continues until the police investigation is completed. Now, it all started when the woman's son tried to escape a cruiser like this one and locked himself in their home. She was sprayed after he was arrested for a long list of charges.
Do it now!
Arthur Blackman was tased and arrested for a list of offenses, including DUI obstruction and carrying a weapon. As the loud and frantic situation unfolded, it was confusing and frightening for everyone. Geneva Smith tried to intervene for her son and was disabled by the pepper spray. Many leaders think that could have been avoided because she was never a physical threat.
An officer had his hands on her and she was trying to comply, but yet being confused, 84 years old, being woke up in the middle of the night with a whole bunch of racket and a commotion that can get you kind of, your mind's not focusing and understanding.
The black leaders also say she was receiving conflicting instructions, but they acknowledge it was a difficult situation for the officers as well. They've already met with the city and the police about making changes, and a city councilman thinks they'll come to a resolution.
I could honestly say the city served, this police department is hurt as well as the community is hurt, so we got to turn that hurt into a healing process.
People who live nearby are still upset about the situation. They don't want anything like it to happen again.
To pepper spray an 84-year-old lady, there's nothing that she can do to harm you without any type of weapon in her hand or anything. There's nothing that she can do to harm anybody.
Now, fortunately, it's clear from my discussions with everyone here that Muskogee wants to be a model for solving these kinds of problems, and everyone is willing to talk about it at length. Live in Muskogee, Charles Ely.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
Another racist incident on Edmonton streets is generating a flurry of reaction. An Edmonton man was filming a commercial about downtown when someone called him the N-word from a car. A confrontation ensued and it was all caught on camera. CTV's Dan Grummet joining us in studio with more on what was said and the reaction to it tonight. Dan.
Yes, Daryl, it happened to Jesse Lipscomb, and he posted the video to Facebook this morning. We're going to show it to you now, but first, a warning, it contains offensive language, but we're airing it because we think it's important to show exactly what Jesse experienced.
A PSA on the love of downtown.
The niggers are coming! The niggers are coming!
Interrupted by hate. Jesse Lipscomb reacts by approaching the car.
You know, I opened the door, and I really didn't want to be aggressive. I literally opened the door. But I opened the door, and I wanted to get down and said level. I just wanted him to say it to my face.
Words are exchanged and denied.
Obviously, they weren't in the mood to talk about it. Side note, the car definitely smelled like booze.
The passenger slams the door.
Get the fuck in.
And the car drives away, but not without a parting shot.
You know, I love downtown Edmonton. I love our city, but it's a real thing, and I'm really happy we caught it on camera.
Jesse since posted the video online for two reasons. Public shaming, he says it was this guy, and awareness.
Let's not be quiet about it. Let's actually put fuel in it so that people are aware and sensitive to the fact that life is different when you have a different hue of skin.
Jesse's experience might be more surprising if it weren't for a similar incident just last month. Cyclist Bashir Muhammad was also called the N-word during a road rage incident.
It's not okay. And I think what's happening now is things are getting caught on camera. I'm becoming more sensitive to other people's issues where I don't just let them slide. Ideally, that's what this video is for.
Phil Fraser is the former head of the Alberta Human Rights Commission. He wasn't available to meet us in person today, but would like to see the commission investigate.
Tell people who these people are and what they're up to. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that they'll pretty soon run for rails.
Jesse says he'll consider filing a formal complaint, but what he wants is a conversation. Because for him, the only justice is one that snuffs out incidents like these.
It could be as weird as seeing people walking down the street in Klan outfits. I want to make it as obscure as that.
Now Jesse says he won't report this to police, although the chief said today he's aware of the video. He says the hate crimes unit's going to look at it, see if any charges are warranted. This video is reaching tens of thousands of people. This morning, it had about 1,000 views. Tonight, it has more than 125,000, and that's on Jesse's Facebook page alone. You can watch the video on our website, edmonton.ctvnews.ca. Daryl.
Okay, Dan, the mayor got involved in last month's incident, even meeting with Bashir Muhammad. Has he commented on this video?
Well, just so happens Don Iveson knows Jesse personally, and he did release a statement this afternoon, and it reads, "I have seen the video, and I condemn the use of racist language by the occupants of the car. No one in our city should ever be exposed to hateful comments like this."
All right, Dan Grummet, live in studio tonight. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome.
According to police, Deadman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over."
Nigger!
I believe in an eye for an eye. I believe what he done was so horrific, I don't think I would talk to him at all.
A dad's anguish after his son is killed. Police say this man, Russell Cordier, intentionally ran over the black teen last month. Thank you for joining us. I'm Lincoln Graves.
And I'm Valerie Hurst. Steve and Deb are off tonight. K2's Reed Andrews is live in Gresham. Reed, Cordier has a lengthy record and is a suspected white supremacist. What's stopping police from charging him with a hate crime in this case?
Well, Valerie, investigators can't prove that the victim was targeted and killed because he was black and not because he got into an argument with a man who is an admitted white supremacist. This right here just filled with all the disciplinary action that that man got while he was in prison. And it started with an argument here on East Burnside when the suspect was just charging his cell phone outside a store.
Larnell Bruce holds two photos of his son, Larnell Bruce Jr. It's been less than 3 weeks since the 19-year-old died after police say he was intentionally run over on East Burnside in Gresham.
I still keep waiting for him to come home. That's probably the hardest part.
Larnell Jr. got in an argument last month with this man, Russell Cordier. Records show that while in prison, Cordier admitted to guards that he was a white supremacist.
It's disturbing that race in 2016 is still an issue.
Witnesses told police Bruce and Cordier got in an argument. Bruce pulled out a weapon to end the fight and then walked away.
We've been working on him trying to learn to deal with his anger, mm-hmm. and to learn how to walk away from things instead of letting them escalate.
Yeah.
So I was pretty proud to find out that he decided to try to walk away.
While Bruce cooled off, police say Cordier didn't. Investigators say Cordier got in his Jeep along with his girlfriend and intentionally ran over the teenager.
I just felt in my heart that my son was, regardless whether it was over his anger or over his white pride, he killed my son, yeah. Bottom line. And I feel like it's a hate crime.
Gresham police say they can't prove this is a hate crime. And for now, Cordier is charged with murder. That pains the teen's father, who feels the suspect deserves more punishment.
My faith says that the Lord will forgive him. I don't have to forgive him until the Lord's taken him. So I don't forgive him until he's dead. That's what I want to see him dead.
There's a vigil tonight at the Rosewood Initiative. That's 161st in Southeast Stark. It is for Larnell Bruce Jr., and it starts in a little less than an hour at 7 o'clock. Live in Gresham Night, Reed Andrews, K2 News.
All right, Reed, thank you.
You've been charged with one count of murder, sir.
Murder is the most serious charge he's ever faced, but not the first. 29-year-old Matthew Desha has a history with police in North Ridgeville, where he lives in this Pine Ridge mobile home.
When his car rolled over, maybe that brought back things from the service.
Put him, like, back in that war mode or something. I don't know why he did that. Because, like I say, a good heart, always respect him. I'm starting to love him like a son. Everybody knew that.
Friend Kathleen Salvatore says the Marine veteran suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder after serving in Iraq. And in just the last few weeks, quit his job and seemed depressed.
He wasn't taking his meds. I don't think he was getting the right help.
She also knows he has guns. Salvatore says she took this picture of Desha with a loaded handgun on July 4th, 2011, an incident that resulted in a charge of using a weapon while intoxicated.
And the gun's like, he's got it down like this, and then I'm taking other pictures with the cat. And of course, some neighbor, you know, just had to go and say, oh, he's pointing a gun at her, he's mad at her, and it was not true.
But just 2 months earlier, a warning on this North Ridgeville police report noting Desha, quote, suffers from PTSD, sleeps on the couch with a loaded weapon. Two officers should respond to the address for any incident, and there are several other weapons in the house.
He'd get real nervous all the time thinking people were after him, and, you know, I think that's why he carried that assault rifle with him.
North Ridgeville police last dealt with Desha in a 2013 road rage incident. Police say a caller reported Desha slammed on his brakes on Center Ridge Road, then got out and yelled at the man. No one was charged.
He said a couple times that people would be tailgating him like they do in New York, and so he would slam on the brakes and walk to the car.
Now he faces up to life in prison after another confrontation, this time leaving an innocent woman dead.
There was a well-documented history in this country that if the shooter is a Muslim, he's a terrorist. If he's black, he's a thug. And if he's white, he has struggled for years with drug addiction, PTSD, and other mental health issues. We are challenging this attitude. We feel that this was a racial or hate crime in many ways, because why did this young man come from far west side to the far east side? And why was this black unarmed woman who had her hands up shot point blank several times with him by a semi-automatic military style rifle? We want to know why he did not shoot the other people and why he did not shoot those that came, these first responders that came as well. So we are well aware of PTSD and its existence, but the fact remains that the only person that was a victim in this tragedy is Miss Pearl. We would like to make sure that the transparency is obvious through this investigation.
We are deeply disturbed at any time when a rifle-toting person, individual, can execute any person, but a black person in particular, on her way to work and have it neatly disposed of as a bad day. Mr. Desha murdered Mrs. Pearl in a violent, cruel, thoughtless way, and we are here to show full support and solidarity for this family and our community.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 3rd, 2016. So I have been told, compensatory call-in. Feel free, dial in if you have commentary, observations you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. You can follow us on Twitter at Until Justice. Certainly we are on Facebook as well. You can retweet. Simple thing you can do. Get the content out to other potential non-white listeners. Retweet link for the program on Twitter, again, at Until Justice. Or you could do the same on Facebook. Use whatever social media platforms you have to let other victims of racism know about the context of white supremacy if you think that would be beneficial. A couple quick things before we get to folks who dialed in. Number one, we have some of our listeners are going to be visiting the New York area coming up soon. I know we have a substantial number of Cal's listeners in the New York City area, not other parts of the state, New York City specifically. So if you are in New York City and would be down to connect with visiting Cal's listeners, you can drop an email, let me know, and I'll forward along information if we have listeners in the New York area. We also have listeners in the Tampa Bay, Tampa, Florida area. If you are in the Tampa, Florida area, same thing. You can drop an email. You can kind of put it in the subject. That would help me to keep things organized. You can put New York contact or Tampa contact in the subject of the email. That would help me. And I will do the same thing forward along. If you're interested in having contact with listeners in that part of Florida, would do the same for folks in other areas. But I know those are two areas specifically that people were asking about over the past couple days or so. Moving along. Next thing that popped up that I thought was of significance in the Lennon Lacy piece, and I think I had mentioned Lennon Lacy earlier this, or last month now, in August, when people were pointing out, observing, it's been 2 years since the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, 2 years since James, forgetting the John Crawford III, that's it. John Crawford III in Ohio was shot and killed at the Walmart. That was also in August of 2014. We're just kind of pointing out some of the anniversaries from the summer. And I said that Lennon Lacy was also 2 years since he was found hanging in North Carolina. And I don't think that got, you know, the same amount of attention way back when it initially happened. And I hadn't really heard very much about it this summer in terms of just recognizing it's been 2 years. Since he was found hanging, but I was glad to hear that piece. But even within that piece, the words used to describe whatever this quote-unquote tragic arrangement with Mr. Lacy, who was only 17, and some white woman that was more than 10 years older than him, they laid out the dynamics of the age difference, but they described it as a messy public relationship. They didn't say, this is statutory rape. They didn't say she was a pedophile. They didn't name her specifically, just a messy public relationship. And that sort of thing, in my view, that consistently, and particularly where whites are exonerated or we're not using the most accurate terms to indict and describe what it is that they're doing in mistreating non-white people, particularly black people, I think that that pattern holds true. It was evident in that piece, and even the connection, because that piece was followed by recognizing the anniversary of Strom Thurmond's filibuster. That would be double cowbell. They didn't bring that up in mentioning Strom Thurmond. I think that is a significant part of his legacy as well, spending all this time talking about the dangers of niggers, but he has no problem fathering a child with a black female, and you have the exact same dynamic, a black female who was significantly younger than he was, again, statutory rape, child rape, again, and this one, I don't believe it was something where he was, 20 and she was 14 or anything like that. I think this is one of those that's really bad where he was significantly older than her, should have been arrested for child rape, statutory rape, as they called it, should have been arrested for that, but of course that doesn't happen, system of white supremacy. Other quick thing I wanted to make sure I got in before we get to some of the callers, I did not include any segments on Colin Kaepernick. I had many, many, many to pick from. White people talking about it, black people talking about it, Bill Roden talking about it. There were tons of them over the week. I took the position that people had probably already heard quite a bit about that, so there was no need to just to continue to belabor that point. I'm sure there will be more said about that in the coming days. And I thought that there were many other things that happened that were more important than that during the course of the week. However, if there is one thing that I was going to say about that, I would just restate what Jackie Robinson said in his autobiography. I said this on Facebook as well. It's been my experience that frequently particularly if it's a black athlete that's going to be chastised, admonished for how he, she responds to racism. It's been my experience that whites, they will bring out Jackie Robinson and say, oh, you should be more like Jackie Robinson. He didn't fight back. He was so classy and, you know, he was mistreated and all that. And he didn't jump up and down and pout about it. He just went ahead and played the game, that sort of thing. Why can't you be more like Jackie Robinson? And I didn't hear Jackie Robinson mentioned this week at all, except during Bill Roden's broadcast and his co-host. He did bring up Jackie Robinson. He pointed to his autobiography. In my view, this is all anyone should say. If I was Colin Kaepernick, I would just reread Jackie Robinson, and that would be that. As they say, this would be the mic drop. Jackie Robinson autobiography, and this is from the preface before you even get into the meat of the text, his autobiography. I never had it made, and I've said consistently we should read this book on the book club because it's been my experience. A lot of folks, a lot of black people, particularly younger black people, don't really know a lot of details about Jackie Robinson, what he was about, things he said, his stance on racism. He writes, "There I was, the black grandson of a slave, the son of a black sharecropper, part of a historic occasion, a symbolic hero to my people. The air was sparkling, the sunlight was warm. The band struck up the national anthem. The flag billowed in the wind. It should have been a glorious moment for me as the stirring words of the national anthem poured from the stands. Perhaps it was, but then again, perhaps the anthem could be called the theme song for a drama called The Noble Experiment. Today, as I look back on that opening game of my first World Series, I must tell you that it was Mr. Ricky's drama and that I was only a principal actor. As I write this 20 years later, I cannot stand and sing the national anthem. I cannot salute the flag. I know that I am a black man in a white world. In 1972, in 1947, at my birth in 1919, I know that I never had it made." Stanford for Connecticut, 1972, when he wrote this Jackie Robinson, and I would add in, put some respect on Jackie Robinson's name, because I consistently hear people begrudge and talk bad about Jackie Robinson. These would be other victims of racism, black people who describe him as a sellout or being the white man's Negro, this sort of thing. Even there was a lot of that during the 60s when he was doing civil rights work and what have you. I think more people, if they knew more about Jackie Robinson, would not do that. But at the end of the day, put some respect on Jackie Robinson's name and make sure I get in as World War II veteran Jackie Robinson. With that, we will get to the phone lines. We'll remind folks, please not use metaphors. If we could be mindful, in my view, that is important, very significant to be mindful about what we're saying when we articulate our views on racism, counter-racism. It's been my experience frequently metaphors, analogies, similes, they are employed when we're discussing counter-racism, and frequently they are not accurate. The things that are being compared are not equivalent, and or these metaphors, they do not make it obvious, certain, unambiguous what it is that we are trying to state. So we could just be direct, explicit about what we want to say, that would be great, and I'll make an effort to prompt about using metaphors. Thank you kindly. If you could kind of take 5 minutes to share your views, and that'll make sure we get everybody in who has commentary they would like to share. Watch the background noise, please, as well. If you could use your mute button, if you know you're in a noisy environment, that would be super appreciated. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Dust. Good evening to all the callers. Thomas Smith in New York. First, I wanted to just make a short comment on the political theater, Trump and Hillary. I think this is probably one of the most entertaining things ever. I never seen a white man called a racist so much ever in my life. It's by design. But this week, he called Hillary a bigot. he challenged her 35-year record in politics, saying she, did nothing but took black votes for granted, and she did nothing for you in 35 years. This is totally hilarious. I just love it. Promoting white life in Italy. I think that this whole trend, the recent trend of this promotion of white life, it started in Russia a few years ago. I remember they had Boys to Men and I think the Backstreet Boys or someone. They paid them a whole bunch of money to go over there to promote white life and to try to spark a romantic revolution there to increase their rates of life. So that's common. At the same time, they're doing everything they can do to eliminate black life. Strom Cowbell Sturman sounded like quote straight from Ben Tillman's mouth. Filibuster to preserve legally lynching people. What stuck out to me in that what he said was he mentioned pools, and that's been something that you brought up several times to us, and I've been paying a lot of attention to that. And pools, the long legacy of preventing blacks access to swimming. And I just saw a report recently where they said it was a report about the black Olympic swimmer, Simone, I forget her last name. But she, in this report, they said 70% of black people can't swim. And I thought that was astounding. And a huge part of that is whites have spent a lot of time and effort to keep us out of those pools and keep pools from the in and out areas. Zika is a report. I first saw it on the elevator at work, and it said 2 billion people to be affected by Zika in Africa and India. And I started thinking, man, these must be some bionic mosquitoes, because I also read a report last week where they said that they were in Utah, in northern Utah, which is all snow-capped mountains. So I never saw mosquitoes live in the wintertime. So, these mosquitoes start in Brazil. They end up in Puerto Rico and Florida, then in the black south, Louisiana, Mississippi, all down there. And now they cross the Atlantic during hurricane season to Africa, fly over all of Africa, over the Indian Ocean to India. I mean, these are some super mosquitoes. I think this is definitely not a mosquito thing. This is something else. And lastly, the white reporter, I believe he was talking about the braids and the hair. Man, he was so racist. I just keep thinking, man, how dare these people go to their country and take over and then tell them how to express their culture, And he was not ignorant at all. He was very refined. And what proved that was how at the end he became the victim, which white people do, especially these refined racists, just teach me. Maybe I just don't know. And I thought that was a trend that they do here a lot, too. So it's worldwide. I mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from, if y'all had commentary, feel free. There are quite a few lines open. It's not Dally. If you have commentary, feel free to share your thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I just had a few things to point out. I think it was the segment about the I think it was the neighborhood or the homes that there was the lady, I guess she was saying something about she was trying to, I guess, get a petition. And I think that was, yeah, that was a white woman, and they used the term the Caucasian clause. I think that's what it was. And the language, I think, like the figures of speech that was being used during that segment, one was, it was written in black and white. Like, I think that was intentional, you know, like that was deliberate by whoever was doing that report. Like, I think he wanted to get like a, maybe a little joke in there or something. And what was interesting was that they said that they had to get, I guess, the majority, whatever that meant, like, of the people that live in the neighborhood. But she was saying, in like, my opinion, it didn't seem like she was being successful at that. She said on her petition that these were people who didn't live in I forgot what the name of the city was or the neighborhood. It was people that lived outside of it. But they said you need the majority of the neighbors. So it didn't seem like she was being accurate about that. So, and then like when I seen that clip from that meeting that they was having, you can just tell that they didn't want to be there discussing that kind of thing. So, you know, I guess maybe for the cameras and stuff, they had to, I guess, put up with the media or whatever. And I have been hearing a whole lot of things about that, the Kaepernick thing, and it has gotten a lot of attention. But the past maybe 2 or 3 days, I hadn't heard much. So as much as I heard was, I guess, he's continuing his protest. And about the Black Lives Matter T-shirt, I think that's what it was about, the girl at the school, and like how those radio hosts, they pointed out that, you know, like I guess the issue wasn't, I guess, quote unquote racial, but then they say, well, you know, well it's one thing to wear the Black Lives Matter shirts, but it's another thing, whatever the thing is another thing when you just start calling names. He didn't say practice racism. So, you know, I noticed they chose their words very carefully. So, you know, and then, like, I like to also point out that I noticed that they'll use the word racist for if someone's saying something, but, like, the person. He went to go on as well. And I'll give it to the next person. And thank you.
At least the updated for the past few days that I've seen is they're upset because now Kaepernick was photographed wearing socks that had image of police officers being depicted as pigs. And so they were really upset. And some of the local Bay Area enforcement officials, they are saying that they're not going to view police 49ers games because they're upset about this. And then our very own Seattle Seahawks, Jeremy Lane, black male, he has joined in. He also is not standing for the national anthem. So they've been talking about that here in the Seattle paper. And if that's going to continue once the season starts for real, I guess, in the next week or so. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Hello, good night. Can
yes.
I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, America. Yeah, so the Star Spangled Banner, that national anthem, that sounds racist. That school was in the news for selling 12 slaves. what else? That song that I've been hearing like every day in the summer, that ice cream truck song, the ice cream truck song, is racist. I mean, racism is American, that's like built into the fabric of America. That's how America was built. The thing with those young females in South Africa. In Jamaica too, we have, you know, we have schools where we have to wear uniforms, and we have like, you know, how you wear your hair. You can't wear braids either, and that's, you know, that's a majority yeah, black country also, which as the Indian lady was saying, it, you know, it comes from like colonial times when white people was physically there controlling the going ons of the country. It's just not there physically right now doing it, but it's still controlled by white supremacy. And I did not know that this racist Strom Thurmond had a black daughter, but I found it very interesting with the that white man that was speaking about it. He was saying, he had mentioned a phrase, and he was saying it was very disgusting to even say it, but he didn't sound disgusted. And then he even said that that's something that he heard growing up, but he didn't admit that that was something that he himself, you know, spoke about. Yeah, he sounded very not genuine at all. He was just, you know, telling us the news. Yeah, I wanted to ask Gus, do you know the officer's name that shot Curran Gaines and his son?
No, if you give me a moment, I can check to see if they have identified the officer.
Yeah, I was looking, and the only thing I could find was his last name, and I'm still curious to know, like, why is his name being held secret? I'm not understanding. Yeah, as usual, there's so many clips, so I'm gonna pass it off here. Thank you.
The announcer, I'm going to dig to see if they have identified the officer who shot and killed Corin Gaines, but the announcer who was doing the report on Strom Thurmond, his name is John Hockenberry. He's with WNY, New York Public Radio. But number one, they began that segment. They read two poems. They read one by Langston Hughes, and then the first poem that they read is by Walt Whitman, which I would have played it, but just in the interest of time, I was not trying to have a whole poetry recital period. But they read this poem by Walt Whitman. And folks who've listened to The Cows before, Walt Whitman, that name should stand out for many reasons. And or Breaking Bad viewers, that name should be familiar. We did a whole program on a graduate student at Northwestern University in Illinois, where his graduate professor was requiring him to do a recital by Walt Whitman, and he refused. On the grounds that Walt Whitman is a racist white supremacist. He bragged, calling black people niggers and saying that it was a mistake to end the enslavement of black people in this area of the world. He wrote about it repeatedly. He does have poems here and there talking about slavery and how they're treated, but he also has quite a bit of just not his performance poetry pieces, but just his regular commentary. Like, yeah, these dumb niggers, like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. Like, they should have just stayed on the plantation. Lots and lots of this is well documented. And that to me, when you talk about insincerity, a lack of authenticity in him reading this, like, oh, this is an outrage. Oh, I can't believe to read this. And I heard this. I did not believe it at all. It just sounded like a total performance. Like, okay, this is the script, and I'm supposed to, okay, it's bad. Yes, stay away from the niggers. Yes, it's terrible. Okay, I'll read. All right. That's exactly the way it came across to me. He's done quite a few other pieces where they've talked about racism, and I got the exact same impression. But for me, just them beginning that segment with the poem by Walt Whitman, that said it all, and I'm sure that he is the type of white, like most, who are not ignorant about Walt Whitman and his views on the Negro. Other folks that we have not heard from, do you all have commentary?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I would just like to start off by saying I am very proud of that young fella, Colin Kaepernick. mainly from the standpoint that his logic that I've been hearing over the past, what now is about 3.5 weeks or so, now 2 or 3.5 weeks, his logic is pretty sound, and it kind of like indicates to me that he is on his own been doing some studying, doing some research over the course of time, and really becoming, you know, really being logical what he has to say. And because I would figure by now, with all of the attention that he's getting, and a lot of it's a negative attention that he's getting, that if it's something that they can really kind of like get after him with, something about his personal life or something like that, they would have been done it by now, let alone talking about his logic. He's aware of the danger. He has stated that he's prepared for the negative consequences. And I just like what I'm hearing from him. I don't know him personally or anything like that. The only thing I do know, he's a non-white person that's a victim of racist white supremacy, and he doesn't have control over anything. But even under those circumstances, it seems like everything that I've seen or heard or listened to, that he's pretty sound in his logic. And I'm quite proud of him of that. I wish him the best in what he's doing, what he's saying and doing, and keep saying and doing it. Having a lot of time. I missed the book reading. I was just listening to it before the program came on to catch up. Friday night is football night for me as a football coach, so it kind of like takes me away from being able to tune into the book reading, and sometimes even on Thursday, so I'm not available. But I do catch it by looking through the archives. That's somewhat of what I've been doing over the course of the week, in as far as race and white supremacy goes, studying wise. Other than that, you know, the things. Oh yes, the one that I posted you about with the. It's just something about that. I know it happens all the time, but what sets it apart for me, as far as the mother of three, I believe, that was murdered by this what I would call the international race soldier. He was a member of the international level of being a race soldier that literally ran his car into this non-white black female, and that wasn't good enough. Gets out of his car, and I don't know if any of the listeners have actually seen and heard the use of an assault rifle. It's kind of like, you know, you swatting a fly with a hammer, and walks up to this woman, and shoots her to death. It's ultimate racism, white supremacy. You can't be more of an explainer of racism and its practice than that, as far as I'm concerned. And what it shows in its almost rawest form is the attitude of a behavior and their thinking of a white person and what they think that they have the right to do to a non-white black person. That's the boldness of it, the boldness of what and I'm not thinking of something that's a rarity. This is how they think, and he carried that out on this non-white victim. Unfortunately, it should be something to be expected of their behavior. So I'm probably not surprising anybody on the other end of this line, but that's what white supremacy is all about. Thank you for listening.
Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary that they wanted to share. Feel free.
Good evening. Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. Good evening to everyone. I wanted to comment on a couple of things. First, the young lady with the Black Lives Matter t-shirt. I know they said it wasn't a racial thing. Of course, that's incorrect. And not just, it just is, because if they did follow up, they would have known that that student also said, well, I've seen, it started with a white person complaining about the shirt. So that would indicate some sort of racism to me. And also that student who wore the shirt pointed out that she saw people with Confederate flag t-shirts and other types of gay pride shirts. And because of that, the policy has changed so that no one can wear any type of t-shirt, I guess, that may spark some type of political thing. So, of course, it is racist. And those journalists, if I could find it, and I'm not a formal journalist, surely they could have found that information. And then second, about the Black businesses, I know myself personally, I live in two cities now that are majority Black, and it's still hard to find these people. I don't know where they are. I look and look, they're not readily available. And I also read an article that said, similar to, I guess, the dating app site, that they wanted to target everyone. So they kind of, I don't want to say hide the fact that they're Black, but it's not very evident. And I guess if they were able to do the research that the journalist who reported the story said, Black people are users, consumers. I know this is not new. I don't think it's brand new that Black people are consumers of everything. And if they really did just focus on Black people, I'm sure they would be fine. But I guess that's maybe some level of self-hate or self-unawareness about being Black and the importance of the Black dollar within the Black community. Thank you so much. Good night.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, we haven't heard from you. If you have commentary, feel
good evening. Good evening and blessings.
Greetings.
Yes, my name is Ifo. I'm originally from the west coast of Africa. I am Isoko, and I currently live in Atlantic Canada. It has been a blessing to listen to your show, and I've been sending a bunch of people to listen to your show so they can get some clarity. I'll share with you some things that are happening both locally and internationally. You heard about their sisters in South Africa with the hair. Did you hear about that?
I played several clips on that at the beginning of the broadcast today.
Okay, yeah, I got in late. Okay. There have also been similar issues like that happening here in Atlantic Canada. I am a brother with locks, and so there have been multiple comments and insistence on stuff. There have been different Canadian restaurants that have sent sisters home because they had natural hair, and that apparently was not acceptable in the workplace. I just heard this morning about someone who went to rent a place and was told that it's whites only. This is 2016 in Canada. I recently graduated with first class standard in computer science. I was told by one of my professors, actually the head of the department, that I did not have the mental capacity to understand computer science.
You know, people are sorry.
And they also claimed that there was nothing racially motivated by that statement. And I have heard reports from other students that there were other African students who were told similar things and discouraged from studying computer science because it was too complex. So apparently, even in 2016, they still believe that we're not equally human. So we live in a strange, strange world. So yeah, that's just some of the things. Oh, the last one. There was a recent discussion about. I don't know if you're familiar that the Nazi Party and got its birth in Namibia, which was considered British German West Africa, and a lot of the people who started the concentration camps in Africa with. Later on went and helped them in Germany to do what they did there. So as a result of the stealing of the land from the black Africans, they passed some resolutions preventing the descendants of those who came, raped, and pillaged the land in Namibia from owning land until they could figure out a way to redistribute land back to the people whose land was stolen. So just recently, I think the Namibian government had made some moves to now allow white Namibians to purchase land again. So there's been a lot of, there's been some commentary from the white populations about how this is all racist and is a great injustice to not allow them to own land. They're ignoring the fact that some of them actually got compensation for the land that they stole. But they think it's a great injustice and don't like to be reminded of the fact of what happened. And they keep claiming that, you know, it's not the same thing as they do in the U.S. where they say, you know, you can't blame us for the stuff that our ancestors did and we had nothing to do with it, while simultaneously enjoying the land and the resources that their ancestors stole to give them what it is that they have now. So they want to enjoy the benefits of what was stolen, but don't want to be responsible for paying reparations for what was stolen. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that we're seeing the same cycle of denial of the rights of Africans to be treated as human beings, even in Africa, similar to what we're seeing in the States and in Canada, with people refusing to acknowledge that we're actually human and getting seriously upset when we demand to be treated with dignity and respect, and when we decide not to respect their white supremacist systems. And similar to the brother who I'm proud of, that he sat down at the national anthem. I also sat during the national anthem that was sang at my graduation, and we're singing something about God Save the Queen. I also sat down during that, and I've often said that there's lots of things that I'd like God to do to the Queen, but I don't think saving is one of them. And that's my brief overview, and thank you again for allowing us to be able to share.
Thank you for the participation. Congratulations on your accomplishment, getting your computer degree. That's awesome. Need more black people with skills in those emerging technologies. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, evening. I'll be too long. Like other people, I too respect what Colin Kaepernick did, not just did, is doing as of this moment. You know, especially when you see especially when you see just the vitriol. I mean, just weeks, I mean, just days of attacks, people like racists on TV, police unions. But I don't know if anyone is aware, this week, Ryan Lochte, the white Olympic swimmer who won three other Olympic swimmers, was involved in criminal activity in Rio while representing the United States, which I think is much more disrespectful to this country than what Kaepernick is doing. Mr. Lochte was just rewarded with a endorsement of a crime prevention apparatus, and he was also rewarded as a Dancing with the Stars contestant. Now, again, this is someone who's engaged in criminal activity while representing this country. But that isn't worse than what Mr. Kaepernick is doing just by sitting down. And as for Ms. Earl, I am so glad that that person decided to call out that bogus statement that is always made. You know, if it's a Muslim, it's terrorism. If it's a black person, it's a thug. If it's a white person, it's mental illness, PTSD. Not that his statement was bogus, but just the idea that what this white terrorist did to her wasn't terrorism. It certainly was. I mean, she's on her way to work and he just plows into her, and that's not enough. And then when you made your comment about how police had no problem arresting him, I thought about the Jesse Williams statement. You remember he said those exact words, how police got no problem de-escalating when it comes to whites. And there's just no question that this guy is the total aggressor committing this act of terrorism. But we see he's arrested without incident. And as for the segment on braids, you know, it's just, I also go back to what young actress Amanda Sternberg had to say. See, when whites like Khloe Kardashian and all of the rest of them wear these braids, see, they don't go through what black ladies have to go through. Being called horrific names. You know, being told it's like disgusting, like that white reporter did, then has the nerve to get upset or claim he doesn't understand why he's being called a racist. And like I said, it's just interesting how people wearing their natural hair, it is bothersome. I mean, these women are not committing crimes. You know, they're not being profane. They're just wearing their hair in their choice. And they're just being hated for it. And when they stand up, I'm proud of them. That's all I have to say.
For sure. Appreciate it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, appreciate that. M1, Roz, certainly feel free. I was just going to add in, I think, also one of the more recent developments with the Colin Kaepernick situation is it's being reported that he is donating his first paycheck for this season to activist causes that are addressing some of the issues that he's been talking about with racism, police brutality, and all that. That's one of the things that came out in the last few days. I think that was, he might have had a whole plan about how he wanted to do this, but I had heard that had been a part of the people critiquing him and saying, well, he's doing all this, not standing and disrespecting the country and the flag and veterans and blah, blah, blah. You know, why don't you donate some of your millions and Now that has been crossed off the list as well, since that just came out within the last few days, at least what I saw. I also thought, just wanted to get in, I thought it was great. The victim's father, Larnell Bruce Jr., that's the teenage black male that was deliberately killed, ran over in Oregon within the last few weeks, hearing his father say that I do not forgive, I'm not with all of that, and that they need to die, the white supremacists. And that's what the news report labeled them as, white supremacists who killed his son. I thought that was great to hear a black person who was not on that turn the other cheek, and it's all good with me, and we just need to pray about all this and forgive. He was not on all of that. He was not on endorsing any of that. Roz, feel free.
Hi, yes. Greetings to you guys and to the callers and the listeners. I was glad to hear that, too, just to piggyback off of what you were just talking about. Just to touch on the situation with Colin Kaepernick, I'm just ecstatic to see what he's been doing. Anything that agitates our enemies is the biggest plus ever. So I wish him the best. I wish him to be safe, because you know how these white people can get. It's really beautiful to see that he understands the system on that level, to the point that he's going to do something about it in any way, shape, or form to facilitate some form of change. So I find that to be wonderful. I wanted to touch on what M1 just brought up, and peace to you too. So I thought about what he was talking about with the de-escalation of the situation of the white savage that killed the black female after hitting her with his vehicle. And this touches on something I've talked about, I think, the last couple of compensatory call-ins, where white people know that they are inherently criminal. They know that they're inherently genocidal, and they make up for it by covering for them and or doing things like not shooting him to death, even though he's walking around with an assault rifle. Whereas with a black person, you can be unarmed and they'll just take you out, you know, make up a story. You know, if you're white, you know, I think they are fully aware of the fact that as a race, they are criminal, and they do everything possible to look out for each other. And I'll throw it again. Hillary Clinton is the greatest example of someone who is just, I mean, she's like a female Jesse James, the way she does things. It's just, she gets away with stuff, and she just has no limits to what, where she's going to take her criminal activity. I wanted to speak on the clip, I think it was the first clip, with the Italians trying to get their people to give birth. And it's funny because I just talked about that earlier today. I was at an event, and I'll touch on that later. And I think I sent the article to you and Thomas as well, an email regarding white people creating an artificial womb. And I think if we just study, also if you look at, there was, I know recently there was, a situation in India where they're trying to stop Indian females from being surrogates for white females because they find that these women are being abused and mistreated. And I saw something about that in an article like maybe 2 weeks ago. So if we look at the planetary situation with white people holistically, they know that they're dying off, and they're basically the planet is getting rid of them. That's why they're dying at a faster rate than they're able to give birth. So the Earth itself, thank you. You're getting rid of anthropomorphic cancer, so I wish you the best in getting that done, and hopefully we can, you know, get if Mother Earth can help us get rid of them, maybe we can state a system of justice. But I just find that telling, a very much a Dr. Wilson moment in regards to the government, Italian government, wanting to make it mandatory for Italians to give birth to more terrorists. To touch on what Thomas in New York talked about in regards to Zika, I've seen an article recently, because I know he was talking about the these super mosquitoes that are turning up in places where mosquitoes don't actually live or are unable to survive in a natural situation. And I saw an article, you may even remember it, where they were talking about the fact that they're trying to find a way to kill Zika in the female vagina, because they find that it seems to flourish and replicate in the female vagina. So I have a feeling that we're not being told exactly how it's being spread. It could be that people are maybe having sexual activity in other parts of the world and then maybe contracting it, not fully aware, and coming back, because from the article they said that it flourishes, it replicates and basically flourishes in that environment so well that they're trying to come up with a quote-unquote remedy for that situation. So I just wanted to chime in with that. Then I found it interesting with the Lennon Lacy clip, rest in peace to him, that they said that he had a temper issue and that he drew his gun on the white guy to back him down, and he walked away. And it makes me think, because I always say when I leave my house, I walk the house, walk the streets as a prisoner of war with the understanding that I'm behind enemy lines. And I thought when he walked away from the white guy, in his mind, the situation was over. And, of course, in the white guy's mind, the situation was never over, which was how he was able to kill this young black male so horribly. And I just think it just reminds me of any altercations you have with white people, no matter how seemingly small, you never turn your back on them and you never let your guard down. That's something that I do and I practice all the time, so I just find that to be very interesting. And lastly, I did go to an event in the Bronx. I was supposed to have a discussion. The topic of the discussion I was supposed to outline was unity in the community. And I just found a lot of things that made me think of Dr. Welsing so much, just in the fact that the event itself started late. The organization was off. I never got to give my discussion or have my discussion at all. And I didn't, you know, I looked at it in the sense that essentially, you know, as victims in the system, it's by design that things that we try to plan that are positive are stymied or thwarted in some way. And essentially the fact that we as victims of racism are mentally ill, I find that these sorts of things, when they happen, are they're expected. You know, it was expected. When it happened, I just said, okay, you know, I just adjusted. I wasn't angry or anything. I wish I was able to give the discussion or whatever, but I wasn't. It was okay. But it just made me think, because throughout the day I was watching them play music and I saw a lot of young children there and stuff. It was an outdoor event, and they knew every dance. I mean, every dance, they were moving in unison. And I talked to one of the guys that was there, and I said to him, I said, if we can get children that young to understand how racism, white supremacy functions, the way that they can teach each other how to dance, and that's what Dr. Welsing used to talk about, I said, we will make serious headway in the system. And he totally understood where I was coming from. He agreed. And then, funny, you talked about Jackie Robinson. We talked about him today as well. And, it was interesting because I was discussing this show with him, and I actually ended up giving information regarding the show to other people at the event. We ended up having like a really great counter-racist conversation that spanned all kinds of things. And I just found that just the work that needs to be done between the Generation Xers and the millennials in regards to fostering that connection where we're passing on life-saving information to our children. I think that is just so essential. And, you know, the event turned out to be positive in the sense that it was black people coming together and not fussing and fighting. And there was a lot of discussion about black unity there. But at the same time, it just made me think of all of the things that we could improve on if we did not have to deal with the system of white supremacy. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you, and I'll mute my line, and hopefully I can chime in later if there's other things that come up in tonight's discussion. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Did want to get in just, I think it might be a correction when you were mentioning the Lennon Lacy, when he was trying to walk away from the white person who eventually killed him. I think that was the teenager in Oregon, Larnell Bruce Jr., who was trying to walk away where his dad was talking about the temper issue, not Lennon Lacy.
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry.
No problem. So many black deaths, unfortunately, it's easy to get them mixed up. The one other thing I wanted to say, the people that have been talking so much about Colin Kaepernick is disrespecting veterans, like Lavina Johnson, disrespecting veterans by not standing for the national anthem. Matthew Deja, the white savage who shot and killed Deborah Pearl in Ohio, is a veteran. So Colin Kaepernick is disrespecting veterans like Matthew Deja with what he's doing. Other people that we have not heard from, we can watch the metaphors as well. Other folks that we have not heard from at all. Line should be open. Feel free if you have commentary.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to the callers, to the hosts, and to the platform. I just wanted to comment on the one clip that mentioned, like, the guy that he didn't get pronounced as, the crime didn't get accounted as a lynching. It was like, it said it was a suicide. I think that that's normal in the system of racism and white supremacy. And then also I read or I saw a news article that was labeled blacks agree with Trump on Democrats, but don't agree with the rest of his message. And then I looked at that as being talking about racism, white supremacy in the area of politics, the fact that we have to choose between Democrat and Republican right now as being the two political parties, and neither one of these parties really represent a view of being against racism, white supremacy, and how that affects us. And so I thought that was significant to be on the internet this week. And the woman that got hit by the racist white supremacist terrorist and, you know, later on assassinated or whatever, you know, once again, I revert back to, I guess, talking about terrorism called Islamic extremism or whatever they want to call it. But when it's racist white supremacist terrorism.
I get background noise from one of the other callers, but should be taken care of. Sorry about that.
I was just saying when it's a racist white supremacist terrorist that, you know, it's this relaxed allegedly supposed to be this relaxed response and lack of action and things like that. And I just think that the response needs to be exactly how it is for the other terrorist groups, as far as drone strikes and things like that or whatever. I mean, hypothetically, I think that, you know, if these type of things happen to the racist white supremacist terrorists when they do things, then it'll be the same thing that, like, when we bomb on other countries or whatever, our enemies. So I just look at that, you know, as being significant to black people and our struggle with racism, white supremacy, and all nine areas of people activity, that we have to not just consume, but, you know, consume in those areas, but we need to own our, you know, own, like, actions and lives in those areas. And that's all I wanted to share.
Appreciate that. Sorry about the minor disruption. Again, folks, if you know you're in a kind of noisy environment, if you could use your mute button just to make sure we don't have disruptions and people being interrupted when they're sharing. Before I get to make sure we didn't miss anybody, I also thought it was significant the incident that happened in Oklahoma where the Grant Black mother, who was in her 80s, where she was pepper sprayed in her own residence. They were at her residence. I believe it was her son where he was stopped by enforcement officials. I think there was allegation or suspicion that he might have been driving under the influence. And then he evaded enforcement officials allegedly and went to his mother's residence. Number one, again, some moron says consistently sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Another illustration. Number two, and again, those are allegations about what he did. He has not been convicted of anything yet. It's supposed to be due process. But I would say, if you are engaged in any sort of incorrect behavior, non-constructive activity, if you're under the influence and you get stopped by enforcement officials, this is not a situation where they are just terrorizing you. You haven't done anything. But if you have done something incorrect, you know you are engaging in criminal activity, and you are stopped by enforcement officials, you should not involve other black people in your problem. If you go out and you're messing around and doing things that you're not supposed to do, things that are not codified that could get you in trouble with race soldiers, with whites, badge or no, it should be, I got it. This has nothing to do with anybody else. I think Mr. Fuller, he encourages, if you're going to be doing something that's incorrect, you do that by yourself. Do not involve any other victims of racism for them to be engaged and potentially harmed because you wanted to go out and engage in some foolishness. I think that is the prescription to minimize that sort of thing happening. Whites, racists, would be most to blame for that situation, but they are certainly, at least in that situation, the allegations about what could have happened. I think there are things that we should put into place to at least make sure that we do everything we can to minimize the likelihood of that happening. And just, again, if you're engaged in any sort of nonsense, under the influence or anything else that you know, this is likely to bring race soldiers down on me. Make sure you don't run to grandmother's house or mom's house, dad's house, sister's house, anybody else's house. You got it all on your own. I decided to do this, so whatever happens, I'm going to deal with it all on me. I think that would be best, unless I'm in error. Anyone that we missed, anybody that we have not heard from at all? Any call? We haven't missed anybody? Everybody who had a hand up, we got them? All right. I would assume we're good. Hopefully people will not wait till the last minute. Did seem like there were some people we hadn't heard from, but hopefully they will chime in and not wait until the end of the broadcast if you have things you would like to share. Folks, have any additional comments, whether you spoke or not, additional comments you wanted to make?
Can I be heard?
We'll get our female caller, then we'll get Thomas in New York.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh.
Did you have commentary, ma'am? We can hear you. Now we're not hearing you.
I'll let the other caller go first.
Thomas in New York, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I think, like I said, during workplace racism, a white female at work came over and wanted to discuss the Kaepernick situation. And one of the things when she was trying to get me to talk about it, you know, she asked me, you know, what do you think they should do with him? And I said, I don't know. I bet he's going to lose a lot of endorsements. So I hope he loses all of them. I wouldn't buy anything. And it's just, you know, that Voltron effect. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see, unfortunately, his career not last too much longer than this season, maybe two seasons. And once again, it brings up Mahmoud Abdul-Raif, also known as Chris Jackson. He was averaging 20 points a game in the NBA and had a short little injury, and before you know it, was blackballed out and ended up finishing out his career overseas. You know, sports have the institution of sports has a way of, you know, being able to keep their product under wraps by everyone there is expendable, you know, and every now and then they have to lay down the law and let that be known. But if this is going to be a pattern and it's going to be uncontrollable, I believe that the standing for the national anthem by the athletes could be potentially taken away. You know, it's no big deal no more. If it's going to put them in a position where they have no other choice, sort of like the Missouri football team put the school in last year where all the players say, hey, we're not doing it. I mean, what really could they do? If they're going to cancel football season because of it, I don't see that. Also, the lady who got shot, which was just a disaster,
it was definitely should be labeled a hate crime. I don't know what other kind of crime you can label this as, but here you have this guy, from what the report I read, he was walking, you know, pacing with the gun in his hand when the police arrested him. And this is in, you know, the same area of Ohio as Cleveland, where the guy, Don Corfitt, was shot holding a air pistol that he just purchased in Walmart. I mean, the video just shows the cop just walk up and just shoot him. There was no freeze or none of that. We saw it to be a license video. Just jumped out the car, shooting, like the blood shooting at the Crips. Just no regard for protocol of, hey, drop the weapon, put your hands up, freeze. And also, this is the same place where the two, the couple, their car backfired, and the cop shot through the window, shot at the couple 137 times. One cop jumped on top of the hood, unloaded the clip, reloaded, just because they thought they heard a shot when that car backfired, so they say. And here they have this white boy who I've listened to the report, the 911 report, and, I mean, these people were frantic. I shouldn't say I listened to them. I read what the people said in the article, what was said in the 911 calls, and it was utterly obvious that the police approached this person knowing he just shot someone multiple times, and still no shot fired. It reminds me of the shooter in Aurora when he shot 77 people inside of the movie theater and gets caught holding a gun right outside. It never happens to us. And I mute my line. Thank you.
Other folks who had commentary they wanted to share, feel free, should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to say about when you discussed the rape of a 17-year-old male. I think that's what I confused with Mr. Lennon Lacey, so I do apologize for that. But I think one of the most brilliant things you discussed is accuracy with words. You know, there was an old proverb that says the first sign of wisdom is to call a thing by its proper name, and that's one thing that that we don't get to come into contact with dealing with white supremacy, is that they really, you know, switch words around and obfuscate facts. And I think that's one of the most extremely important things, because Neely Fuller's always talked about the fact that language is a tool. It's something that you use to most accurately communicate with other people. And I think that's one of the most important things that we can do to fight the system, is to be as accurate as humanly possible when discussing things, and especially when you're talking about the rape of black children by these terroristic white females. I think that that's just one of the most important things ever. And finally, I was listening to the caller that called in, I think, from Canada, and he had talked about, he used the term blessing or bless. And I know the connotations with which we as black people use it, but if you go online and look up the word, the meaning of the word, as far as the etymology of the word blessing, it actually means blood sacrifice. That's the origin of the word, and it actually it's the etymology online dictionary. So I'm trying to remove that word from my vocabulary, simply because when you tell someone, whether it's God bless you or whatever the case may be, essentially you're telling them that you hope they become a blood sacrifice. So just the accuracy with terms, that's something I wanted to throw out there, because when I learned about it, it shocked me. And I was like, wow, okay. So now I know this is one word I have to remove from my vocabulary. So I'm working actively to do so. It's just something I wanted to toss out there. Thank you.
Other folks have commentary, particularly if we have not heard from you. You should speak up before we get to the end of the program. But if other folks had additional comments, things you wanted to make sure you address, feel free. Wow, people are getting their thoughts together, or I don't know if folks are satisfied, but while folks are getting their thoughts together, did anybody see Gabrielle Union's op-ed in the LA Times yesterday?
Yes, I did, and I will.
Yes.
The emails, you know, I think you too, Gus. I was asking, what did you think about her comments? Did you think this was being done by the white supremacists? Or do you think she was sincerely making these comments because she was a victim of rape, which I didn't know about?
There was nothing that I saw that made me think she was not being truthful in her commentary. She mentioned racism. There was a specific paragraph where she talked about Gabrielle Union is married to basketball player Dwayne Wade, folks didn't know, actress, blah, blah, where she talked about she and Dwayne Wade talking to their children about racism and how they have to function as black people in a system of white supremacy. Like, I seriously doubt that a racist would have included a section on racism in a report that didn't necessarily have to mention anything like that. So to me, it seemed like, you know, something that she would have, that didn't come to my mind in reading it and thinking that, oh, racists wrote this or altered it or did something to distort what it was she was going to say. I did think, number one, she mentioned that she read the transcript of the accusations against Nate Parker. Gabrielle Union is one of the actresses in Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation about Nat Turner. She said that she didn't know about the allegations in the court trial and everything before everything came out this summer. And apparently the character that she plays in the movie is gang raped by some racist whites in the film. But she said after she heard about all of it, she read the 700-page transcript. That stood out to me because I've heard many folks who have talked about this, most of them in opposition to Nate Parker and saying they're not going to view the film, white and non-white. And a lot of people have said that they read the transcript or they read part of it or they read all of it. Not one person who has said that has linked to the full transcript. And I said last week, I have not been able to locate the full transcript. And even when she said she read the full 700-page transcript, it was not linked. I am greatly suspicious, not of Gabrielle Union, because she's the only person that actually put a number on how many pages are in the transcript, which I suspect it would be pretty thick. I am greatly suspicious that a lot of these people, white and non-white, who are saying that they've read the full transcript are not being truthful, because it's just been my experience that those transcripts are thick, and I seriously doubt that a whole lot of people are going to be willing to give up their summer to read a 700-page court document from almost 20 years ago, and it doesn't seem to be that easy to find the full transcript. But the kind of concluding thought I had about all of it, I didn't have a problem with anything she said. I didn't think anything that she said was inaccurate or whatever. I thought it was fine. And her addressing, even sharing that she was also a rape victim, which I didn't know either. But what I did think was whites have done a phenomenal job with how they have orchestrated all of this and having everyone dissect and judge Nate Parker, again, someone who has been acquitted, forget innocent until proven guilty. You can be proven proven innocent, and still we are going to relitigate this and go over and have everybody do a character assessment of you again, that they just have done a phenomenal job. And particularly after I read her piece, I was reminded Amy Goodman, my BFF at Democracy Now!, they have been at the Sundance Film Festival every year for at least 4 or 5 years. They were there last year, the year before, they've been there. They were there this year where Nate Parker's project was easily the most talked about film at Sundance this year. They did not mention that film at all, like not one word. They didn't interview anybody with the cast. They didn't even mention when the film sold for $17 million, not one word. I said something about that back then that I thought that was peculiar, that they, Democracy Now!, you're right there, and this is the most talked about film, and they tend to talk about whatever the most popular film is, and particularly films that talk about racism, they will talk about them. Last year it was Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. They talked to Stanley Nelson and Kathleen Cleaver. The year before that it was Dear White People. They talked to the filmmaker. They did a whole segment, massive, it was like 40-minute segment on the program about that. I think the year before that it was Ryan Coogler with Fruitvale Station was there. Every year they will talk about, you know, if it's a big film on racism that's there. nothing. That stands out as being even more suspiciously peculiar now, given everything that's happened, that they had nothing to say about that film way back then. I will end there. I would encourage folks to read the report. I didn't think anything was incorrect about it. I didn't think that racists had done anything to try to alter her testimony in the LA Times.
I wanted to chime in on that, too, because I was actually in on that email thread that Thomas sent to all of us regarding that. And I didn't have an issue with anything she said either. And I talked about that in my response in the email. But one thing I thought about was that I read a couple of different articles from people who were in support of Nate Parker, who also claimed that they read the full transcript. And they said reading the transcript made them question even more the fact that he was even put on trial in the first place. So I don't know if there's information there that really exonerates him to the point where the people who were in support of him said, I don't even understand why this is even an issue. Whereas it seems like with Gabrielle Union, when she wrote the piece, she said it gave her more things to think about. But I'm thinking also the fact that she is a victim of rape herself also might be one of the catalysts for why she's viewing it differently from what I saw in the people who said that they were in support of him, and they also read the transcript, and it made them look at the way that situation was handled in a totally different way as far as it being a focus on Nate Parker that didn't need to be there. So I think I would love, and like you said too, I did like an extensive search for that transcript. I remember the first time you put that information out there, and no matter how hard I searched, I couldn't find anything on it. I would love to be able to read it or at least have access to it. So, you know, you can make up your own mind as to what really transpired there. But I just think it's just crazy how these and racist, how he was exonerated, you know, completely exonerated. And this thing just keeps getting rehashed and rehashed and rehashed. And you have someone like Marv Albert, who basically raped a female and bit her up and wore women's lingerie, who got fired for his assault of her, got another job on another network, and no one ever talks about that again. Now it's like a dead issue. But with Nate Parker, it's being tossed around. And lastly, I just actually came across an article that was talking about the fact that Jerry Heller died, NWA fame Jerry Heller, at 75 years old. And I was just thinking to myself, how these white people, how racist they are, how they rob us of all kinds of ability to be financially prosperous. And then at the same time, they live to ripe old ages, like 75, 80, 90-something, 100. And we're dying like Prince at, you know, 53 years old. And, you know, Natalie Cole died, I think, at like 65. It's just really disgusting how these people are the worst criminals that have ever walked the face of the earth. And they live, you know, long lives. And, you know, we just don't get to survive that long at all. And like I've always said, I don't think anybody that's non-white, and specifically black, I don't care if they died at 100 years old, I think that none of us, ever since white supremacy has been instated, has died of natural causes. I think we've all been murdered in some form or fashion, and even if we're not consciously aware that we've been murdered, we've all been murdered until the system has ended. Thank you.
Lennon Lacey at 17. Rob in Wisconsin, did you have commentary, sir? Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings to Gus and the rest of the callers and the listeners online. Just wanted to chime in really quickly. Seeing that hair really stood out today. And I had an observation here in Milwaukee during the quote-unquote unrest. It was a beauty supply store that burned down. So it was some footage on Facebook where the store was doing cleanup and they threw like some of the old burnt hair, or I don't know if it was actually burned, maybe whatever. They threw the hair away and they had a video on. It was like a big thing. The police got called out and everything. And, with the hair, black women's hair being such a issue this week, it just really seemed to stand out that the system of white supremacy have us not even just appreciating who we are. And the last thing that I wanted to chime in with is I'll be starting my second semester of college coming up after the quote-unquote holiday. And I finished the first semester with a 3.6. I was one grade from all A's. And I just want to keep that momentum going into the second semester. And thank you for taking the call. I'm Ian Milan.
Awesome. Spectacular. Maybe you can get that 4.0 this semester. They definitely do not want to see black excellence in the classroom. So that is counter-racist work right there, to do the best that you can, academics or whatever it is that you're doing. But that outstanding. I know Dr. Welsing would be proud. That hairpiece in South Africa that got so much attention this week, it reminded me, the BBC, they had done a segment earlier this year where they were saying that black people, black females specifically on the continent, they are making major trends towards going away from the chemical mutilation and chemical straightening of their hair and going natural, and that they see in the next 50 years that is what's going to be the dominant form of what black females are doing with their hair, some natural form of styling and wearing their hair, and that the whole weaves and straightening and all that, that's going to be a really small thing in Africa. Their projection was sometime in the next 20, 50 years or so, that's what it's going to look like. They just see a major movement in that direction now. So hopefully this will aid in that, in empowering more black people, black self-respect, that you do not need to conform to racist standards of beauty, how we should think, what we should look like. But it will be interesting to see how that continues to evolve, because at least what I saw, the school in question, I think it's called Pretoria Girls High School in South Africa, they said that they were suspending the policy on what black females were supposed to do with their hair. They didn't say that they were permanently changing. They just said that they were suspending the policy, which, you know, language and just being attentive to what is actually being said. Other folks have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is the caller from New Orleans, Princess. I just want to comment on the news about Kaepernick. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Basically, I don't know. I've been getting conflicting views from a lot of black people as far as his ethnicity or what his race is or how he classifies himself, if you will. So I was wondering if any of the other callers were hearing other black people, you know, describe him as not being black, or, you know, if there was some type of measure of blackness that somehow he's not actually black.
I did hear some of that this week. Both just people commenting, and it even got mainstream. There were commentators, Rodney Harrison, he's a retired football player, who made a comment basically saying the same thing, that he didn't think Colin Kaepernick was black enough and that he doesn't experience the same type of mistreatment and terrorism that individuals who have two black parents are, the way that they're going to be terrorized. Kaepernick, he has one white parent, one black parent. He was adopted by a white family. All of this is very public and has been for quite some time. They went to the Super Bowl in 2013, if memory serves, and they tend to spend a lot of time talking about all the people that are involved with the Super Bowl, and that was a major component of them talking about him, since he was the quarterback for the 49ers at that game. So, yeah, there's been a lot of that. If people have seen him, he is not the most melanated person in comparison to, you know, Lil Wayne or Dick Gregory or Lupita Nyong'o. He has a lot less melanin than people that would look like that. But I don't think there are going to be a whole lot of whites, particularly now. I seriously doubt you're going to find too many individuals classified as white who are going to say, oh, yeah, that Kaepernick guy is white. I think his racial status as a non-white person, if it was not clear before, it should certainly be unambiguous at this point. But I have heard some of that over the past few days.
Okay. Glad you cleared that up. Because basically, I would have to say that no matter where this goes, I just hope that people on the ground, primarily us, who are in the know, are just speaking to people within our immediate circle. And just take it as an opportunity to, you know, speak to people about, you know, racism, white supremacy. You know, when this statement, as I read the initial statement, I just was quite moved because he was very clear in what his initial stance was, because I had shared on the show a few years back as far as me and my experiences as to why I never stood for the Pledge of Allegiance. I never caught too much flack while I was in school because I guess because I was just coming from overseas and people was just trying to figure me out. But I just never put myself in situations where I would have to go to anybody's game. Even now with my nephew playing for Boise State, I know my dad, you know, he's following all of his games and all this stuff. But I would just, I didn't put myself in certain situations where I would have to be put on the spot. But when I was, like, at least when I was in school, you know, I've had a couple of teachers or whoever asked me, and you know, I just said I it was my personal belief, and really just attributed to the way I was being treated. It was kind of similar to my answer to when I first decided not to be an organ donor. The white person at the DMV had basically asked me why I didn't want to, and I just said, well, I pretty much, you know, I live in a country that doesn't respect me in life. How can I possibly, you know, donate parts of my body in death to help the system? Something along the lines of it, like that. And I just remember, you know, how she was looking at me, and this was way before I became into the know of anything. It was just, you know, just following logic even then. But I did think about the case with Lavina Johnson, the black female who was raped and murdered in the military, and how that case has went unsolved. And then, you know, as you know, the veterans came out trying to say basically, oh, well, you're disrespecting the veterans and the military and this, that, and the other. I would just say, you know, use that as an opportunity to bring up cases like Lavina Johnson. And, you know, Dylann Roof, you know, he can burn a flag and nothing is said, but just because, you know, he sits down or whatever the case may be, and, you know, white people are just losing their minds over this. So, I just take the opportunity for what it's worth. You know, like I said, it's just, and just use it as a teachable moment for the people around you. And I'll mute my line.
Outstanding. Try to take advantage when you can. For the caller that chimed in before, who was asking about Corinne Gaines and the officer that shot and killed her, they did release his last name only this week. They said out of concern for the officer's safety, they do not release first names of officers when there's an officer involved shooting. So they just identified him as Officer First Class Ruby. And that's all until, I guess, they resolve the situation, what have you, which is White Lives Matter. Moving forward, with the whole Kaepernick thing, it reminded me, I did not stand for the national anthem. We were at a high school basketball game. I was in high school and very confused, but I guess had some level of understanding. So I didn't stand. I was with all black people in the stands. And it was the most pitiful. That's, you know, we're all victims, but all of the black people were furious. That was like that was our conversation for the first quarter of the game. Was not even the game. It was, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that you did not stand for the national anthem. I am disgusted, and I'm not even have to rethink if I want to sit next to a Negro like you for the rest of the game. That was our conversation. It was not supported. It was not cool. Not even one of the black people I was with was pleased about me not standing. So I did remember that with all of this. From the past week. Did anybody have either commentary, the Gabrielle Union op-ed that was mentioned? Did folks have commentary on that or anything else folks wanted to address before we wrap things up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, really quick. I think it was a segment about it was a bank, I guess someone owned the bank. It might have been some black people. And the lady was saying that she didn't want to come off being labeled as the black bank or black business or something like that. And I found that very interesting, you know, the plights and the difficulties that black people have going into the business arena, and this, how the system definitely tries to still keep them at a limitation. So I didn't really get to listen to that whole segment, but I just remember her making that commentary. And it was I think that other segment about the guy who was up in Boston, and he said, like, when he went up to the car, and he said, I guess he smelled some alcohol or something. And the guy, I think from what I heard from that segment, he was saying, I guess the niggers are coming. And it sounds like that's from some kind of movie. Like, did you think that when you heard that that segment, like he did insert a nigger in there, like for something else, like monsters or something like that? Did you think that when you heard that clip, Gus?
If that's the segment where they were in Edmonton, where they were out filming the diversity video, whatever that means, and the white guy said, "Oh, the niggers are coming." And he went up and he said, it seemed like he smelled alcohol in the car, so maybe that was an excuse for why they called him a nigger. That's the segment you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so you said, what was it you were saying about it? Maybe it seemed like they inserted, so just restate it for me, please.
It seemed like from how the suspected racist, like how he was saying the niggers are coming. It seemed like he borrowed that from a movie, like from a movie or something, or some kind of, I guess, story or something like that. And I know how they like to make those kind of jokes, but they'll put like a slur in it and then make their own version of it.
Got it. Yes, it very much sounded exactly like if you've seen any sort of a horror movie, you know, oh my gosh, the zombies are coming, the apes are coming, the alligators are coming, the same thing, the niggers are coming. It sounded the exact same way if you've heard any sort of horror flick where there's some sort of beast coming to decimate civilization, exactly the same way.
And then, like, one last thing is, like, I heard, I can't remember what segment it was, but they brought up the term hate crime. Like, I don't think too many people have really gone into in-depth analysis of, like, defining, you know, what does that mean? You know, how does it function and all of that? Because when, you know, the term, that term nigger being applied to black people, it doesn't seem like people are being charged with that. Like, man, that's in my opinion, that is a deep crime right there. But, you know, when the victim responds in a physical way, they end up being the ones getting punished. So even if, you know, the victim doesn't respond in that kind of way, you know, I don't see anybody, well, obviously any white person being punished for that. And in my opinion, I think that's just because of the system that we're in. So I guess they try to make it seem like, you know, well, we're going to see if we can get some hate crime charges pressed on on the race of the person, but nobody never really seems to think that, hey, this word, hey, it's, everybody's always using it, you know? Like, even the young people are saying that. I hear people say that all the time. So you're going to, I can envision a white person saying, hey, you're going to call me out and label me a racist, I'm going to point all of you out because you're saying it right along with me. Like, hey, like, if you're going to say that I'm one, then all the rest of you and a lot more of you do the same thing with me. So I think that might be one of the reasons why they don't, I guess, punish them for that. Like, you see what I mean when I say that?
Why they don't, when you say why they don't punish them for that, are you saying why they don't prosecute with the hate crimes, or why they, just explain that part for me?
Like, I guess like when you have all these situations, even from like average everyday people and, well, like average everyday white people and people who might be principals or police officers or doctors or, you know, lawyers, and they're all practicing racism. But when a situation happens, like if someone is called a nigger and, you know, the black person, I guess, either does or doesn't respond. But when it comes to the white person being punished for using that term, like, they don't seem to get punished just for, you know, using the slur, using the word nigger, because I think that they don't want to, I guess, bring it to that level, I guess, unless it's some kind of physical act done. That's what I was trying to say about that word hate crime, because it doesn't seem like it really goes that far. I mean, because, like, what constitutes is a hate crime, because that doesn't involve, you know, racism. They may say it could be something against Jews or, you know, or the Matthew Shepard thing. So I just think that went into a whole bunch of confusion. But when it comes to the actual act of racism, I just think they don't want to start labeling white people as racist for using the word nigger, because a lot more of them are doing it. So they don't want them to pretty much end up saying a lot more other white people are the same way, if that make any sense.
That does make sense. I agree. I know we had Dr. Welsing on the program. This is some years back, where she gave her counter-racist perspective, was that we should not use the term hate crime, quote-unquote, because it's not specific. And I think, as you were saying before, that could be applied to it. You could end up saying, well, hey, black people are committing hate crimes too, you know, because you did something, you said nigger, or you said, you know, this, or you said something bad about this group of people, for whatever the reason may be. And I have seen that, where they have even looked at or even talked about charging a black person with a hate crime because they did, you know, whatever they were accused of having done. I agree. In my view, it would be much more accurate. And I think you even touching on the logic of why they do not just say that we're going to prosecute this person for practicing racism, practicing white supremacy, that they are not going to do that because they makes it too clear. And then if a person has been prosecuted for an act of racism, I mean, hey, logically, you could say this person is a racist if they have been prosecuted, convicted for an act of white supremacy racism. And they certainly do not want to go there, where you start having a list of white, and then you would have to have a firm criteria as terms of, this is what qualifies as an act of racism, something that can be prosecuted. And they certainly do not want anything like that to be started, because they know there would just be a massive list of whites who could potentially be charged, like, right now. So absolutely, I think they, words that's been mentioned consistently, they do not want accurate labels for these crimes. That's why they will encourage hate crime and discrimination, prejudice, things like that. I think even John Robbie, the white man who was talking about the hair issue in South Africa, he says, the worst thing to be called a racist, and I've been called that all week, and it's terrible. Oh, it's the worst thing ever, which is just total nonsense. He just wants to continue to be effective in his ability to practice racism. If people are saying that he's racist, that makes it much more difficult for him to do so. And I think, as Thomas pointed out, him playing the victim again. But yeah, that my assessment. Hopefully it made sense. Folks were able to grasp what's being articulated. If you have questions, if you have something else that you would like to submit, guest suggestions, or just commentary on something that was shared this evening, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We will be back early in the week. You can check the Black Talk Radio page for updates, the Facebook page, Twitter, all of the above. Feel free. And again, if you get confused, you can drop an email and we will try to get you the accurate information you need about the CAL's upcoming programs. The problem we had with the stream at Black Talk Radio should be corrected. I think this is third or fourth program that we've done in the last 4 days, and we have not had a problem. I haven't heard anybody tell me that they couldn't access the broadcast listening at Black Talk Radio Network. I am still waiting for the folks at TuneIn to update the stream. You can continue to submit emails. I have done so. Mr. Reed has done so. Many other listeners have done so. I and Mr. Reed emailed the exact stream that they need to update, and they still have not done it. In my view, that's just an act of racism. I'm very certain that whites are in charge at TuneIn, and just them delaying. I think Mr. Reed had similar issues with them updating other programs at Black Talk Radio Network, including his own, and it taking a very long time. And this is not something that should take a lot of time, just switching out an URL. But these are the type of difficulties and delays to be expected in a system of racism, white supremacy. But I'll post that information on Facebook again if you want to drop the support team at tunein.com another email. I'm making sure to include the address to our stream because people have emailed and they've said, oh, if you want to add your network to our directory, that's great. Just send us all your info. We are already in the TuneIn directory. This is not that deep. All they need to do is update our stream and people could go back to listening to the program on TuneIn Live and the archives. So I will stay on that. Hopefully we'll get that corrected sometime soon. I'm also working to see if we can get the live content at iTunes as well. I'm no fan of having to deal with them directly either, but we'll see. We'll see if that works out. Hopefully we can get more spots available for people to be able to listen live. With that, we have done our three. We'll be back early in the week. Thanks for the folks who tuned in. Hope you got some constructive information. I know this is a quote-unquote holiday weekend, so I would just encourage, if you're doing anything to kind of wrap things up for the summer, if you're having, you know, a party or you're going to the beach or whatever you are doing, remain codified. Racist white supremacists, they do not take vacations. We cannot pause our counter-racist efforts, at least being codified. If you're going to consume any alcohol or any intoxicants, as I've said, I would get to one spot and stay there. I would not be bar hopping or doing anything where you're going to be out and about and you're under the influence. You just never know when you're going to come in contact with a race soldier, badge or no. It can be a dangerous, life-ending situation, and I mean quick, in a matter of seconds. Certainly, you do not want to be intoxicated behind the wheel, and that's intoxicated on anything. You never know when that will be the day that you come in contact with Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldiers. Again, badge or no, do everything that you possibly can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That includes buckling up each and every time you are in a vehicle. I was in a car yesterday with two expecting parents and nobody was buckled up. It's like, come on. In addition to that, is excuse enough right there for John Law to pull us all over and tickets and anything else just on that basis alone. Buckle up. That's very, very easy counter-racist effort. Buckle up every time you are in a vehicle. That's it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.